All right, good morning, everybody. This is the Wednesday, October 7th, 2020 morning session of the Portland City Council. Keelan, please call the roll.
Good morning. June Daly?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Ryan?
Here.
Hardesty?
Here.
Wheeler?
Here. Under Portland City Code and state law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the Council are attending remotely by video and teleconference, and the City has made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The meeting is available to the public on the City's YouTube channel, eGovPDX, www.portlandoregon.gov/video, and Channel 30. The public can also provide a written testimony to council by emailing the council clerk at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. The council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and to promote physical distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. As always, thank you for your patience, your flexibility, and your understanding as we manage through this difficult situation to conduct the city's business. And with that, we'll hear from legal counsel on the rules of order and decorum.
Good morning. To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while the City Council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected for the remainder of the electronic meeting. Finally, please be aware that all council meetings are recorded.
Very good. First up is communications. First individual, please, Keelan.
Number 789, request of Marlene Wallingford to address council regarding ending cooperation between Portland Police and the Joint Terrorism Task Force and improving annual report.
Are they on?
Can I speak now?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're up with Marlene.
Oh, okay, thank you. My name is Marlene Wallingford, and I'm with the Portland Japanese American Citizens League. If members look at the Zoom participant list, you'll see that some group members are signed in with asterisks in front of their names in support of our testimony today. So our organization, the Portland JCL, has been working with a coalition of groups to remove cooperation with Portland Police with the Joint Terrorism Task Force for several years. We were concerned about the use of tactics that would be inconsistent with our federal and state constitutions. During World War II, we were labeled as potentially disloyal and removed from the West Coast because of our race. Since immigrants from Japan were not allowed to become citizens, we had little political power. This argument of military necessity turned out to be a lie. A secret document, the final report on the Japanese evacuation from the West Coast, explicitly stated that intelligence sources found that Japanese Americans posed no threat to U.S. security. So even when the government's own investigations found no threat, this information was kept hidden, and the media spread false information about the danger the Japanese were to national security and fanned the flames of fear. Special wartime orders were enacted. There was an 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew here in Portland, a 5-mile travel restriction, and we needed to turn in our firearms, radios, cameras, and other contraband, which was only directed at the Japanese, not Germans or Italians. In Portland, this city council took away all business licenses of Japanese-owned businesses, and over 100 community leaders were arrested within days of Pearl Harbor by the Portland police and the FBI. So the FBI investigated Buddhists as a potential threat. Buddhists were considered to be less loyal than their Japanese-American Christian counterparts. Similarly, people who studied Japanese or traveled to Japan were looked upon with the same suspicion. We need only exchange this fear of the Japanese to Middle Easterners and Muslims to understand that we are still stuck with the biases and stereotypes of the past. So in the aftermath of 9/11, the Patriot Act was passed. This act gave increased powers of investigation to the FBI, which violates our constitutional rights and allows our government to investigate without just cause. This is a structural problem and not a problem of just this administration. So we have worked with local community groups to encourage the city council to stop assigning Portland police officers to the Joint Terrorism Task Force. We have a dream that people will be judged by their actions, not by the color of their skin, their religion, or their political affiliations. So we encourage the Portland City Council to fully divest from the Joint Terrorism Task Force and to stand up for our citizens' rights. We must continue to be vigilant because our freedoms are being challenged. We must divest. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And before we move on to the next speaker, Commissioner Hardesty has her hand raised. Commissioner Hardesty.
Yes. Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to asked the speaker if she was aware that we actually have pulled out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. We did that in the early part of last year. There are very strict rules where that ban would be lifted. So, Marlene, I'm a little confused about whether you believe that we are currently more involved than we as the city council have dictated.
Well, yes, I was part of that effort to get Portland police out, and we're very happy, but there is still a little window where cooperation can occur, and we just wanted to close that window.
And thank you for that, Marlene. So the only way that can happen is with the approval of the police chief. And it has to be under a very clear, direct threat. That is my understanding today. If you know something different than that, I'd love to know. But
no, I mean, that's what we are concerned about.
So you're concerned that the police chief has the authority to allow that cooperation? Even in the narrow cases that we have dictated.
Right.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to be clear. Thank you.
Good discussion. Keelan, next individual, please.
Number 790, request of Brandon Mayfield to address council regarding ending cooperation between Portland Police and the Joint Terrorism Task Force and improving annual report.
Good morning, Brandon. Let's see, is Brandon still muted? Keelan, can you see? Brandon, we can't hear you.
It looks like he's unmuted now. Brandon, are you able to?
Is he on a phone or is he on a computer? I can't see from my station.
Yeah, it looks like he's on a computer and it does look like he's unmuted. Brandon, do you want to try to unmute again?
Why don't we do this while we're working on Brandon? Let's move on to the next speaker and we'll come back to Brandon. I had this same problem the other day where it showed me unmuted, but nobody could hear a thing I was saying. So you may have to log back in or something.
Okay. 791, request of Brian King to address council regarding ending cooperation between Portland Police and the Joint Terrorism Task Force and improving annual report.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. My name is Brian King. I'm representing Portland Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. For a year, DSA, with other groups involved in this effort, have warned of abuses of J2TF agencies. And this summer, their crimes and outrages have become abundantly clear. The FBI, DHS, Customs and Border Protection, CBP, and ICE have all committed human rights violations. At Portland protests, DHS paramilitary arrested journalists and shot them in the head with less lethal weapons. The FBI and DHS allegedly conducted illegal cell phone surveillance, and CBP paramilitary abducted protesters. At the funeral procession of George Floyd in Texas, the FBI had aerial surveillance, and CBP deployed 6 sniper teams authorized to use lethal force. Last month, an ICE whysistleblower reported mass sterilization through hysterectomies at an ICE facility. The UN Genocide Convention defines several intentional acts as genocide, including sterilization and forced transfer of children. All that's missing to qualify ICE's acts as genocide is systematic intent. Of course, the city wants to hide its cooperation with ICE. In the January hearing on the JTTF report, the Portland police representative said that PPB is not involved at all with ICE, but also said that Homeland Security Investigations is a partner. Homeland Security Investigations, HSI, is a branch of ICE. Under Police Directive 810.10, PPB can work with HSI and ERO, the other major branch of ICE. PPB had a training facility contract with ICE until the contract was revealed by DSA and its coalition partners. The city works with ICE inside and outside of the JTTF, continuing the city's history of supporting white supremacist mass incarceration. The 2020 JTTF report showed that there was no credible threat of international terrorism in Portland. The actual use of the JTTF has been Islamophobic, anti-Arab harassment, and suppression of racial justice protests. In response to this summer's protests, Attorney General Barr said that protesters would be investigated by JTTFs. We should expect federal investigations to be politically targeted, Islamophobic, anti-Black, and biased toward the far right. Brutal racist policing will not end when Trump leaves. Joe Biden's response to protests has been to propose more money for policing. The state police who govern Governor Brown and Mayor Wheeler allowed to be deputized as part of Trump's forces for the September 26th rally turned against Black Lives Matter protests afterwards. Portland police have killed 40 people since 2003, disproportionately Black. And for all that time, Multnomah County has been dominated by the Democratic Party. Democrats built and run the white supremacist police forces of American cities such as Portland. White supremacist policing from the city to the state to federal task forces form one system with bipartisan support. DSA rejects more policing as a solution to community safety. The biggest threats to safety come from our out-of-control paramilitary law enforcement. We call on Portland City Council to end all cooperation with the JTTF and to allow public testimony on the JTTF reports as steps to true safety. And we are aware that we withdrew from the task force, but there is a window where we can still participate. And because of these outrageous crimes, acts of these agencies within the JTTF, we believe we have to sever all cooperation. The terms of cooperation can actually be fairly large. We mentioned in our testimony at the resolution that the threat to life can be interpreted very broadly. For instance, a protest at the ICE building.
Thank you.
It looks like Brandon Mayfield may have tried to rejoin.
Oh, good. Brandon, let's try Brandon and see if he's connected. Brandon, let's see if we can hear you. Are you showing him unmuted, Keelan?
No, I'm still showing muted. Would you like to? Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Just a moment. Let me.
Can you hear me?
Yep, we got you. There you are, Brandon.
So I'm not sure if you're hearing me. I've got you on my phone and my computer, so I'm going to turn one off.
Okay, well, we got you somehow. We hear you loud and clear.
Hello, can you still hear me?
Yep, you sound good.
Okay, great. Good morning, salam alaikum. Before I begin, I want to thank all of you for the work you have done in the face of these trying times that we find ourselves in. As I stated before, I have the utmost confidence in your fidelity to our Portland and Oregon values, which is to establish security, to promote the general welfare and preserve our civil liberties. And also, while I have her here, I want to personally thank Commissioner Fritz for her outstanding record of service. To get to the meat of what it is I want to say, federal task forces like the JTTF and deputization of state and city police is part of a joint effort to expand federal law enforcement activities that are well beyond their jurisdiction and authority. Local law enforcement and policing is a right, it's an authority and a power not granted to the federal government and is left respectfully to the state and the people per the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. The FBI can and should continue to investigate federal crimes, but we shouldn't continue to formally work with the FBI or other federal agencies, assigning officers or resources to assist them in unlawful investigations of non-criminal, suspicious, or un-American activities without the restraints of state and local laws, which some of which, as you know, are to protect our civil liberties, our privacy, and to prevent investigations without probable cause, for instance. And to do so, to continue to work with the FBI, these federal agencies, in light of what we've seen recently in the streets of Portland and the political maneuvering of the White House, the DOJ, and the AG's office, would be irresponsible, and it would also turn back a long history of hard-won basic civil rights. So the recent assaults by federal officers against Portland political protesters and members of the media of the streets of downtown Portland, in a nutshell, show us that the federal law enforcement officers should not be trusted, nor are they authorized to do the kind of policing they're increasingly trying to engage in. And to highlight that, we only have to look at the U.S. Attorney's Office refusal to withdraw the deputization of the 56 police officers that were deputized. And I understand it was your understanding it was only going to be for that weekend. I find this problematic. And again, it just highlights the problem. I agree with you, Mayor Wheeler, and Commissioner Hardesty, that President Trump, including the federal police, have not only failed to prevent violence, but have actually escalated violence in connection with the local protests. Protests that started because of abuses and an excessive police power that ironically were met by federal police and agencies, such as the Marshals Service, FBI, DHS, ICE, and DEA, with, again, excessive force and abuse of power. But to your credit, and I'm talking about all of you at City Council, you did not sit idly by. On July 22nd, you, the City Council, acted unanimously, banning Portland police from working with the federal law enforcement. So again, I thank you all for your unanimity and your action. But you're not the only ones that sat idly by. So shortly thereafter, Blumenau and 14 other legislators, in a joint statement to DHS secretary, you know, asked them to leave. So in summary, I just want to say that for all of these reasons, we believe the time is right for Oregon to be part of a national movement to protect residents and citizens from further political civil liberties. And we're asking and calling on you, the City Council, to end all cooperation between the PPB and the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, including disallowing any temporary assignments of officers to work with the GTTF. And to
Brandon, you're going to have to you're way over 3 minutes.
Expand annual reporting. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to make a quick comment, and then I see Commissioner Fritz has her hand raised as well. I just want to be very clear on the record what happened with regard to deputization. We were not aware of it. there was no local elected official that was aware of the deputization. And our city charter makes it very clear that it assumes civilian oversight of local law enforcement. And a decision of that magnitude, there may have been legitimate operational reasons to consider that, but that is a decision that should have been made with either myself as the mayor and the police commissioner, or at least one of our elected city commissioners, having, you know, to make a decision that from the perspective of the federal government not only lasted for the duration of the governor's declared emergency, but apparently from their perspective, it was a decision that was being made on behalf of the Portland Police Bureau for the remainder of my first term without any engagement or any involvement of any local elected officials. And so that's the basis of my objection to the federal government. And I agree with your commentary around the nature of the overreach. The fact that when, as the elected official in charge of the Portland Police Bureau, said, look, we're not going to do this beyond the weekend. You had it for the weekend. We didn't know about it. We can talk about that later. But this is not something that lasts for the remainder of the year, not without further engagement and involvement of local elected officers, particularly in light of the ordinance that you, or the resolution that you mentioned earlier. And the federal government basically thumbed their nose at us and said, it doesn't matter that we made this decision without any elected oversight at the local level. We've made the decision and you have to live with it. And that does not sit well with me. And so what I've proposed, having heard nothing, by the way, from our federal partners or our state partners or others, I've decided to convene these parties and we'll talk it through and we'll make sure it doesn't happen again. But what I want you and others to know in the meanwhile is I've already sent a written directive to the Portland police chief, making it crystal clear that our officers are not deputized. And if there's a legal difference of opinion, well, we'll just have to iron that out in court. But from my perspective in the here and now and the perspective of the Portland Police Bureau, our officers are not currently deputized under that agreement that was reached without the involvement, engagement, or inclusion or agreement of any local elected law enforcement. So I just wanted you to be aware of that point. I appreciate your testimony. Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm glad you made that point. And I wanted to thank Mr. Mayfield for his kind words at the beginning and indeed for his leadership over the years. Brandon, you've been a person who had something really dreadful happen to you. And instead of getting bitter and just walking away, you have engaged really meaningfully and constructively in helping the city council and others understand the issues with the FBI and the JTTF. And you've really worked to make things better as a result of the experience that you had to endure. So thank you for that. I would expect that Mayor Wheeler would be happy to meet with you to have a deeper discussion about these issues, because you're certainly somebody who I appreciate your advice and find it very meaningful. And although I'm retiring, I know that there'll be others on the council who will continue to want to hear from you. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I have the utmost confidence in you and all of you and the work you've done, and I know you get it, and we're just continuing to push to preserve our civil liberties, our rights, and our values under our state and local laws and constitution.
Thank you. Keelan, next individual, please.
Excuse me, Mayor.
Commissioner Hardesty, I'm sorry. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Brandon, for your testimony today. As you know, we have an annual report about how or if Portland police are engaged with the JTTF. And you started your conversation saying that you wanted to strengthen the reporting process. If you have some recommendations that we should be considering as we prepare for the January report back, I'm very open to that information. So please feel free to reach out to my office. Derek Bradley is my policy person, and he would be happy to work with you on that.
Thank you, Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. And I and our coalition will certainly continue to liaison with you and all of the commissioners.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you being here today, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you. Keelan, next individual, please.
792, request of Simab Husseini to address council regarding ending cooperation between Portland Police and the Joint Terrorism Task Force and improving annual report.
Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Wonderful. Yes, greetings, assalamu alaikum, Mayor and respected commissioners. For the record, my name is Simab Husseini, co-founder and vice chair of the Oregon chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE Oregon for short. We joined a coalition effort in 2017, the year of our founding, hoping to continue the bright, to bring light to the darkness that is JTTF and provide proof with credible testimonies and targeting of its Muslim communities. As a coalition, we brought you testimonies from Michael German of Brennan Justice Center, 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement and served as an FBI special agent where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. Michael dispelled the myth that JTTF presence protects a community when it did not in notable shootings across this nation, from the Pittsburgh synagogue to Fort Hood and even the Boston Marathon bombings. We brought CARE San Francisco Bay Area's executive director, Zara Bilu, who helped organize the withdrawal of JTTF from San Francisco. Zara testified that JTTF targeted mosques, homes, and workplaces, sometimes even targeting minors at schools, questioning about their religion and politics. We filled the council chambers and all overflow rooms with Portlanders supporting the withdrawal, provided testimonies from over 30 community members. We heard from Millie Hobesh, who at the age of 10 watched her father get wrongfully taken away from her for almost 2 years, and after her home was raided, leaving her to sacrifice her childhood to help her mother raise her younger siblings and live in fear. An imam just last year was forced to have his citizenship revoked in order and leave the country in order to just come off of a no-fly list and no longer face persecution. A community now lays traumatized in its wake. We have a store owner in North Portland whose livelihood was threatened if he did not sign up to be an informant on his Muslim community. We have a Portland man who went on a business trip only to be put through a five-year ordeal of imprisonment and torture on his way back if he didn't choose to become an informant on his own Portland community. This is a force in which if you're approached and you have the wherewithal to invoke the right to an attorney, you get threatened, detained, potentially tortured, put on a no-fly list, and live the life of persecution, as have numerous Muslims in this community for absolutely no other reason than being a Muslim. Today, we further call on for expanding the annual reporting required by City Resolution 37424 to include the nature of closed cases referred to the PPB, to the FBI, including the demographics of persons investigated and disposition of cases, which apply to any cases handled before the end of cooperation. There must also be contemporaneous oral public testimony taken when the 2020 report is made in January, as indicated in our coalition letter to you. We would be happy to forward this to Derek Bradley, Commissioner Hardesty. To conclude, as a mayor that is also both police commissioner, if you're not going to be told about the deputization of your own force, what else will you not be told about? We really, really encourage ending this relationship with JTTF and expanding upon that. Thank you.
Thank you. And just to be clear, it wasn't just the feds that neglected to share that information. The operation was actually under the leadership of the Oregon State Police and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office.
Thank you.
Next individual, please.
793, request of Reverend Lynn Smouse Lopez to address council regarding ending cooperation between Portland Police and the Joint Terrorism Task Force and improving annual report.
Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yep, you sound great.
Okay, it's great to be with you today virtually. Thank you for this opportunity. I am Reverend Lynn Smouse Lopez, pastor of Ainsworth United Church of Christ and member of the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition. And I too am calling on you, the Portland City Council, to end all cooperation between the Portland Police Bureau and the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. And as a pastor of a multiracial, multicultural congregation, we're committed to working for justice, especially racial justice. And I need to say, enough is enough. We hear your words about justice, but we await real action for justice. I know you are working on it. I know you're trying, but there's more that needs done. The AMA Coalition and many others have struggled for years for transformational change. And we did succeed a bit to get the two part-time officers off of the Joint Terrorism Task Force from the Portland Police Bureau. But that continued cooperation when in a case of terrorism or an assumption or expectation of danger, which is so wide open. I agree with the previous speakers who said we need to close the door on that. Well, this Joint Terrorism Task Force or the targets religious minorities, as you've heard, and people of color. It traumatizes our communities. And the past records reflect very little is done to prevent domestic terrorism by white supremacists, but continues to impose trauma on Muslim, Arab, and other community members. Most recently, we've seen how the federal force is sent here, which I know you did not want. And I appreciate that, but they continue to pick up peaceful protesters and intimidate and suppress our right to demonstrate. They did nothing to bring peace to our city. So we ask that you totally cut relationships and tell the police chief that has to end. The deputizing needs to end, which I know you're also fighting for. We also expect that the report for 2020 that's given in January bring out the demographics of people investigated by this task force and the nature of closed cases and the disposition of those closed cases to let the public know what really happened and then give them a chance to respond. I ask this as we continue to work together to make Portland a more just society. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Thank you for all who testified during communications. Next up is the consent agenda. Keelan, have any items? It's a short agenda, but if any item has been pulled off the consent agenda?
We've had no requests for items to be pulled.
Please call the roll on the consent agenda.
You Daly?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Ryan?
Aye.
Hardesty?
Aye.
Wheeler? All right, the consent agenda is adopted. First time certain, item 794, please.
Authorize a contract with the lowest responsible bidder for the Better NATO Forever project.
Commissioner Daly.
Thank you, Mayor. My office championed the Central City in Motion plan, which Council passed in November of 2018. We've worked with PBOT since then to accelerate work on the plan, especially the Rose Lane related projects on the Burnside Bridge and approaching the Steel and Hawthorne bridges, which reduce delays in our public transit systems citywide. I'm excited to see the work on the Southwest NATO Fixing Our Streets project underway, bringing new pavement, safer accessible crossings, and a two-way bikeway on Southwest NATO south of Hawthorne Bridge. I want to highlight PSU students and community volunteers' work, which led to making Better NATO not just a seasonal or temporary project, but a permanent feature of our growing network of bikeways. This could have been a challenging and controversial project, but through hard work and creative problem solving, I'm pleased to share that we have a project that improves cycling accessibility and enhances access to waterfront park. The project does all this while installing modern controllers and detection for NATO's traffic signals, allowing them to dynamically adjust to traffic demands rather than the static programming that exists today. And I know that anyone who's ever driven down NATO knows what I'm talking about. It seems like you hit every red light every time. It also improves access to Portland's smallest park, Mill's End. Mill Ends? Okay. PBOT project manager Gabe Graff is here to answer any questions you might have. Welcome, Gabe.
Mayor, commissioners, my name is Gabriel Graff. I'm a project manager with the Portland Bureau of Transportation. Thank you very much for having me here today. I have a short presentation, which I will attempt to share with you starting now. Are you able to see my presentation screen?
Yeah, yes. We can see it.
There we go.
Got it.
Awesome.
One sec before you begin there. Is maybe it's just the view I have, but can everybody see the full slide? I'm only seeing about three quarters of it. Can you, Chloe, it's good for you? Okay, then go ahead. Just the way I have mine configured.
So Mayor, commissioners, I'm just here to request permission to bid the Better NATO Forever project. If you can see this map, I'll just orient you to the project. North here on this map is to your left. The blue line on the map represents Better NATO Forever, the project which will be. And the pink line is our Southwest NATO Fixing Our Streets project. This project is currently under construction. The Better NATO Forever project runs from the Steel Bridge to the Hawthorne Bridge. The Southwest NATO Fixing Our Streets project currently under construction is from the Hawthorne Bridge south to I-405. The two projects were designed by the same team and will connect seamlessly. The southern project in pink, we hope to have wrapped up in construction in July. And this new Better NATO Forever project, given permission to bid today, would be under construction, would overlap with construction, and then be completed by the winter. Just a quick overview. The project has had a long history. Commissioner Daly touched on it. First started by Better Block PDX as a volunteer-led pilot project to demonstrate sort of the potential of the NATO corridor and to provide better access to waterfront events. The first pilot was a success and it returned again in 2016. And then the baton was passed to PBOT in 2017 to implement a seasonal version of Better NATO. We're directed to gather input on the project from the public and stakeholders, and we wrapped that into our Central City in Motion planning effort, which, as the commissioner noted, was adopted by council in the November of 2018. NATO was one of those 18 projects that were included in that implementation plan, and we started design on this project back in the spring of last year. Just share a couple photos for as sort of a flashback to 2015, 2016. The first project was done with spray paint and cones. Ryan and Gwen, who I think will be able to speak with you a little bit later, were some of the original instigators of the project, are shown here on the left. But very very early in the morning, a group of volunteers got out to demonstrate what more space for people walking and accessing those events on NATO Parkway might look like. And here are a couple of before and after photos showing the issues that their Better NATO project was designed to address. During those busy waterfront events, people were spilling into the roadway to try and access them. And once the cones were in place, there was much more space for people to safely get to the waterfront, get to Cinco de Mayo, Rose Fest, and such. when PBOT took over the implementation, we switched to these white removable posts, which you'll still see out there today. And we found that in addition to supporting the waterfront events, the project provided more space for walking and biking and rowing on NATO. Our before and after evaluation showed that when Better NATO was installed, we see that 2 times more biking on NATO than the waterfront, and that cyclists are 3.4 times more likely to ride on NATO with a two-way facility present. This demonstrates that the project both grew cycling usage overall while also reducing conflicts on the waterfront between people biking and walking. Our 2017 data showed that 1 in 3 northbound commuters on NATO Parkway were on bike in the PM commute. And of course, people continue to use the facility to access events and festivals. On July 3rd in 2017, one of our 24-hour video counts showed 15,000 people using Better NATO to access Blues Fest. So we had this demonstration project on the ground, but we were considering options for making a more permanent facility. And we've rolled that into our Central City in Motion planning effort. We got tons of feedback on this Central City in Motion plan, which was designed to provide faster and more reliable transit, a low stress bikeway network, and safer and more accessible crossings in our Central City. Of the dozens of project ideas considered, we presented 3 different options for NATO Parkway, landing on the one that addressed the feedback we received from the majority of Portlanders. An accessible sidewalk along the west side of the park, a comfortable two-way bike facility, make every effort to minimize tree impacts to the park, and leveraging modern signals to mitigate vehicle delays, as the commissioner mentioned. We had tons of engagement. We had over 9,000 participants in our online and in-person open houses, focus groups with Central City Concern, a survey of downtown hospitality workers, 50 meetings with business representatives and associations in the Central City, mailers to all adjacent residents and property owners. Got a lot of feedback, and Better NATO became one of the 18 projects that was recommended for implementation when Council adopted the Central City in Motion plan. Now I'll attempt, which is probably ill-advised, to show you a little video rendering that we used for the open houses for the project last year. And maybe you can just give me a nod if the video is coming through on your screens there. Is that working? Oh, good. Thank you. This is from earlier. The project details have changed somewhat, but it sort of gives you a sense for the project. I won't spend too much time on it, but we're here starting at the northern end of the corridor, and we're starting to fly south. So we're just headed under the Burnside Bridge. You'll see just sort of the major elements of the project. We'll use concrete curb along the side to separate cyclists from the roadway. This section is near Station 1, Ankeny Plaza. The decorative bollards will be removable so Saturday market vendors can load and unload. As we head further south, you start to see the new sidewalk along the west side of the park pick up. And sort of, wow, we've used creative design to make sure to preserve as many of the trees as we could, and wow around existing signal poles and things. You also note these new pedestrian refuge islands that are sort of between the bikeway and the roadway. Those will shorten the crossing distance for people trying to cross NATO, make that safer. Another feature that we really worked hard to is to make sure that access into the park was thought through. Here we are at Harvey Milk, and you can see how a cyclist who wanted to go north or south on NATO from downtown would enter the facility. Heading further south, you'll see the design on the corridor is largely consistent, using similar treatments throughout. Shannon, who will speak next, can speak about how we worked with the Parks Bureau to make sure that access to the park for those big vehicles that need to get in for the rides for Rose Fest and still are able to get their trucks in. And here we're reaching the end of the project. This is approaching Salmon Springs Fountain.
And this, I'll pause right after this, but you'll see as we sort of go under this Hawthorne Bridge ramp here, we're plugging into the project that's currently under construction. And you'll see it's sort of a seamless transition for people cycling. Here's the new the Hawthorne ramp and the new traffic signal that'll be installed there. And I'll let this pull out a little bit and go ahead and pause. This project continues all the way south to down to Harrison. But with that, I'll just take a moment to let my colleague Shannon speak a little bit about the waterfront trees.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, I had you a second.
How about now? Can you hear me?
Yeah. That's... You are cutting in and out. Sorry.
Sorry, I'm on my phone. I just want to make sure you can hear me.
Now we can, yeah.
Okay, great. Sorry about that. Thanks, Gabe, and thank you to Mayor Wheeler and the councilors. My name is Shannon Sims. I'm an associate at Mayor Reed. We're a landscape architecture and visual communications firm here in Portland, and we're an Oregon certified WBE. We worked on this project with the engineers at David Evans Associates, with whom we also worked on the Southwest NATO project, the piece that Gabe mentioned earlier that's south of the Hawthorne Bridge. We have a long history of working with PBOT and also the Portland Parks Department, and we have a number of projects on this waterfront, including the East Bank Esplanade, Selwood Park, and many others. And I want to highlight the collaboration that we had with PBOT and Parks to ensure the integrity of waterfront park, that is preserved as we implement better NATO. The addition of the sidewalk to the east edge, the east of the existing curb, does fall within the root zones of many of the park's large mature canopy trees. And so we worked closely with urban forestry and a consulting arborist to evaluate the conditions of those trees.
Southwest Shoals Ferry Road.
And what you'll see on the screen here is a visualization of that tree assessment. We found that the majority of the trees in the park can accommodate a 6-foot sidewalk without any issue. There are a few places where we made adjustments to the design of the sidewalk in order to avoid an adverse impact to a tree. There are several other places where during construction we'll be giving special treatment with the oversight of an arborist to ensure that there's no critical root damage during the installation of the sidewalk. There will be a total of 12 trees in the park that are removed. About three of those were identified during the tree assessment as dead, dying, or dangerous. And so those, as soon as they're identified, they become a priority for removal no matter what the project does. And several more were identified also as in poor condition or declining health. The project is replanting trees in the park to maintain that continuous row that you see today along the east edge of NATO, as well as planting many trees in the right-of-way and also off-site. Can I go to the next slide? As Gabe mentioned before, Waterfront Park, of course, is a place where we gather for festivals and celebrations. And we worked very closely with parks in order to understand how those events will function in the future and the permanent version of Better NATO. In particular, I want to thank events coordinator Carrie Coker and the maintenance supervisor Jennifer Trim, both at parks, who really worked very closely with us to help us understand the needs, the access needs that they have into the park. What you see on the left is an image of some analysis we did looking at several of the large events that occur in Waterfront Park. They're all unique. They have different footprints. They have different needs for access points for pedestrians and also access points for vehicles that are providing equipment and supplies for those big events. So the design does include designated access points for maintenance trucks for everyday maintenance from parks, all the way up to certain places where you can pull in a semi with a Ferris wheel on it. We also coordinated with them on the placement of that event fencing that you see along NATO when those events are going on to make sure that the sidewalk will be able to remain open during events and also be able to accommodate all of the tents and rides that are set up in the park. Next slide. And last but not least, our coordination with parks was not limited to Waterfront Park. And as Commissioner Udaly mentioned earlier, Mill Ends Park is Portland's smallest park. It also has the distinction of being the smallest park in the world. So it is 3.1 square feet. It's located in the median on NATO Parkway at Taylor. It has a very long history. In fact, it predates Waterfront Park. And over the years, it has gone through many redesigns. So this project will be moving the park about 2 feet to the west and slightly to the north. It will still have the distinction of being the smallest park in the world. We're being very careful to preserve its size, even though we're relocating it. And it will offer a safe and more accessible place for people to enjoy it, to take pictures, and of course, cross the street. Thank you.
Thank you, Shannon. And that sort of concludes our presentation. The project design is complete and Kermit is ready to bid the project. We're hoping by bidding the project now, we can coordinate construction between the two NATO projects, reducing impact to the public. We'd be happy to answer any questions. All right, very good. Does that complete the presentation? Yes, no, maybe. It does, yes. We've got two invited testimony from Ryan and Gwen, but happy to answer questions now or turn it over to them.
Well, why don't we see before we do the invited testimony, did anybody have any questions so far? I'm not going to ask a question. I'll make a statement because I'm not sure I want to know the answer. But please make sure we have resolved clearly who is responsible for maintenance of all of those planters. Because I know we've run into that question previously on other transportation projects where we have planters involved. That's all I will say. You need not say more, but I really want that resolved clearly in advance. Thank you. On to invited testimony.
Ryan, would you like to go first?
Sure. Hello, commissioners and mayor. Thank you for your time. My name is Ryan Hashkin. I run a small business here in Old Town in the Central East Side, Icicle Tricycles. We manufacture ice cream bikes and cargo bikes for folks around the world. I'm one of the key members of Better Block. I was the acting chair during Better NATO, and I was the project manager and instigator of Better NATO. We're a volunteer group. Better Block PDX is a volunteer group that's focused on activating public space and creating a reimagination of public space in our city. We use low-cost materials and temporary traffic control to reimagine how public spaces can be utilized. I'm really excited to see that Better NATO become a permanent fixture of Portland. Waterfront Park has long been a space of civic engagement and activism from the time of Governor McCall and Harbor Drive. And our group, Better Block PDX, was hopefully continuing on that legacy by working with partners at Rose Festival and the Brewers Fest and PSU and PBOT especially to help test out and collect data to pilot this idea of reconfiguring the roadway to make it more usable for the 700,000 plus festival attendees that come every year to the Waterfront Park and to all the other folks that enjoy our waterfront. Better NATO was a great example of how citizen activism and the city can work together. Better Block had worked with PBOT on some projects in Old Town on 3rd Avenue and 2nd Avenue and Ankeny Plaza that were quite successful. And it was great to continue that and bring in other partners like Rose Festival and Brewers Fest for this additional, for Better NATO. I think had we not piloted this project and collected data on it, we might still be arguing about how to have people not spill into the street for Rose Festival or for Cinco de Mayo. I think this project helped also lay the groundwork for your ambitious plan with Central City in Motion. And I really want to thank Council for approving Central City in Motion and making this project one of the key early investments of Central City in Motion. I want to just thank you all for your consideration and support of this plan. And I want to again thank PBOT and City Council for that partnership in having us as citizen activists pilot this idea, collect data, and be able to further that community conversation with this piloted idea. So thank you for your support in the past, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you, Ryan. That was a good presentation. Before we move on, I see Commissioner Hardesty has her hand raised. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I just want to thank Ryan. When I was running for office, he took me on a walk down, and he was so excited about this project. The hundreds of hours, probably thousands of hours by now, that you have put in as a volunteer, your enthusiasm for this project really came across. And even today, you've been doing this for a long time. Even today, you're still excited about the potential of this project. So I just wanted to take a moment and just let you know how much I appreciate your leadership and actually getting the City Council to where now is actually going to be a thing, a real thing, and not just a temporary thing. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty.
I made you blush too. I see that.
Thank you. Good. Commissioner Daly.
That completes our presentation.
We have one more invited testimony from.
No
worries. I'll go quick. My name is Gwen Shaw, and I'm a volunteer with Better Block PDX, also a transportation consultant here in town, but here speaking as a volunteer. In 2015, I was a senior engineering student at PSU on the Massey College of Engineering and Computer Science, and I was the project manager on this project on Better NATO, working with my classmates. It has been such an incredible journey working with Better Block and the traffic engineers at PBOT and the wonderful partners that Ryan has alluded to reimagine NATO Parkway and manage the influx of visitors to the waterfront park and create a safe space for people to travel on NATO and to reduce conflicts between people walking, biking, driving, rolling, anything that they're doing. It's been so gratifying to see the evolution of this project since that first morning when we got the grant, got on the ground at 4 a.m. and installed it all by foot and skateboard. No cars except to deliver all of the equipment to the Salmon Spring Fountain, which was really fun. I feel that Better NATO is our baby, and as such, I've taken opportunities kind of throughout the last several years to kind of provide suggestions and ideas to Gabe and to kind of help. You know, there's big differences in temporary projects to construction, and it's been so exciting to see some of those things that we couldn't do in a temporary fashion come to life in this permanent design, and problems that we couldn't have resolved in early phases being addressed and being fixed. So it's very, very exciting to see that. I'm excited to see all the feedback, all of that reflected in that final design, and the sidewalks, the safer crossings, the dedicated bikeway, and of course the trees, preserving and replanting those has been a big thing for Better Block is you know, we don't want to impact anything negatively. This design puts people first, and it's a design that makes Waterfront Park better, and it's a design that's going to continue to transform NATO Parkway as it has for decades and decades now. So thank you, Mayor and Commissioners, and the PBOT team and everyone that has made this project what it is today.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks both to Ryan and to Gwen. Excellent testimony, and thanks for your passion and your leadership. So colleagues, if nobody has any questions right now, we'll open it up for public testimony. Keelan, is there anybody signed up?
So we had one person sign up for this, John Pearson, but I believe he was just observing. Let me unmute him and we'll ask. John, did you want to testify on 794? It doesn't look like it, Mayor. I don't, We didn't have anyone else sign up.
All right. Well, I think that's a good idea. We should just randomly call on somebody every meeting and just see see if they want to participate. I think that's awesome. Thank you, Keelan. So this is an emergency ordinance. Is there any further discussion before we call the roll? Thank you all. Keelan, please call the roll.
You, Daly.
Oh, wait, sorry. Commissioner Ryan found his hand raised button. Commissioner Ryan.
Yeah, actually, I do have a question, and I wanted to ask why the engineer was on the panel. I really like that you have those pedestrian islands. I find them really helpful. And I had a couple humbling moments where I know to look for traffic, but I might miss a bike coming. And I think because we have the proclamation about White Cane Day, it just makes me want to know, is it synced? And I also like that you talked about the synchronization of the lights on NATO. I've been one of those people that's noticed that as Commissioner Udaly pointed out. So my question is there actually pedestrian, do the bikes and those rolling in that area, do they have a light as well? And is it synced with the cars? It's not a gotcha question, just a curiosity. And then for safety for our pedestrians.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you, Commissioner. For people who are seeking to cross the street using a crosswalk, there will be a pedestrian signal head that will show them when it is safe to cross. They'll have the opportunity to either wait in the park or to wait in a pedestrian refuge island if they want to shorten their crossing distance. Pedestrian signals will come up regularly, but if you want a faster response time, you can push the PED button, and those buttons will also provide auditory guidance for folks who benefit from that.
Thank you, Gabriel. And that means that there's also then a light for the bikes and those that are rolling on that lane.
Yes, there will be several bike signals installed along the corridor at most intersections. The most common design is the interface between people walking and people biking across that sort of that green swath that we saw will be sort of a reinforced version of what is out there today. So pedestrians can cross the bikeway when it is clear. If a cyclist sees a pedestrian who's waiting to cross from the park to the refuge island, they'll stop. But that interaction, most of the crossings will not be signalized. And several of the more major ones will be.
All right. It's nice to hear that development. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very good. Thank you. With that, Keelan, please call the roll.
You, Daly.
Well, I'm a big fan of this project. First of all, I have a special connection to Tom McCall Waterfront Park because my family's general contracting company did the excavation on the waterfront, and as a kid I got to go down there and watch my dad operate the backhoe. And while the waterfront park is of course a vast improvement over what it was before then, I think it has a lot of unrealized potential, and I feel like this project is just another step toward that potential. So I'd like to thank staff at Parks and Recreation, particularly Ross Swanson in Capital Projects and Joel Smith in Urban Forestry for their help and guidance throughout the project design. I also want to thank Better Block PDX volunteers and the original group of PSU students who first conceived of and designed this project. This would not exist without you, and I hope you go down there and dance in the lanes to celebrate. I'm really looking forward to bringing more of the Central City projects to council as we move forward with construction. I vote aye.
Fritz?
Thanks very much to staff and all of yours for all your work. This has been a long project. Aye.
Ryan?
Yes, thank you for that presentation. It was really wonderful. I appreciated all the visuals. And now I know a little bit more about Better Block PDX. I want to thank the volunteers who came in today. That was inspiring. Aye.
Hardesty?
Yes, I want to appreciate the volunteers that started this project, sold it to the community downtown, and worked their hearts out to make sure that we had the data to make sure that this made sense. It's just always wonderful to know that sometimes it takes government a little while to move, and sometimes community volunteers can move much faster. I also want to reaffirm the question that Mayor Wheeler asked about, so who's going to water all those pretty flower pots downtown? Because if we don't have that decision up front, there may be some assumptions that will end up costing the city additional resources down the road. So I really appreciate the mayor asking that question, and I vote aye.
Wheeler?
I appreciate, Commissioner, that you understand and appreciate why I asked that question, because it comes up every year in our budget on the transit mall. And it's like clockwork every year. Whose responsibility is it? And we'll get this one resolved in advance. And on a really serious note, I also want to thank the community folks who are engaged. I really appreciate what Ryan and Gwen said today, and the passion, the energy, and the leadership that they've provided. It takes a great vision, and every great vision in Portland has come from the community. The other part of the combination is it takes leadership at City Hall and good bureau work. And so, Commissioner Udaly, I want to thank you for your advocacy of this project. And I want to thank the bureaus. There are several bureaus involved in this effort. And I want to thank them for their hard work and their collaboration to make this work. And yes, there was compromise as well, because of course, some people had objections over the course of this process. And I hope they believe and that they hear that their concerns were also taken into account as this vision was unfolded and pen was put to paper. I think it's great. I think it's iconic. I think it's one of those things that makes Portland really unique and special. It helps on a whole host of fronts in terms of our Vision Zero goals, in terms of our climate action goals, in terms of the health and well-being of the community, and encouraging more active transportation. This is a win-win-win. And I'm excited to vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Thank you all for your tremendous advocacy and your hard work. Next up is item number 795, proclamation.
Proclaim October 15th, 2020, White Cane Safety Day.
Colleagues, on October 15th of each year, we celebrate the many achievements of the blind and visually impaired or low vision people in our communities and recognize the white cane's significance in advancing independence. People who are blind in Portland utilize white canes or guide dogs to navigate safely and independently to access daily living activities and services in our community. The 2017 U.S. Census reported an estimate of over 14,000 people who are blind or low vision who live in the city of Portland. As our city has grown, the need for attention to safety laws has obviously increased. Today, the city of Portland recognizes the importance of bringing awareness to safety concerns here in Portland that impede the independence of our blind, visually impaired, or low vision community members. And with that, I will turn it over to Commissioner Daly.
Well, thank you, Mayor. I appreciate the opportunity to read this proclamation today in honor of White Cane Safety Day. As many people know, I am the mom of a young man with a disability who uses a wheelchair, and I spent many years before coming to City Council as a disability around school and community inclusion. As your transportation commissioner, I've advanced policy that prioritizes the needs of Portlanders with disabilities in our shared right-of-way. White Cane Safety Day is an excellent representation of the intersection of disability and transportation. To me, this is a critical opportunity for all Portlanders to think about how different people experience our streets differently. For blind and visually impaired Portlanders, a white cane is a vital tool for safety, access, and independence.
for Portlanders who use a wheelchair, every curb without a curb cut is an obstacle to accessing and enjoying our community. And for deaf and hard of hearing Portlanders, visual communication in our transportation system is critical. We call our shared streets the right-of-way because it is a public good. It is our right to walk, roll, bike, and scoot in our city. And we have the right to do that safely, or we should have the right to do that safely. I'm committed to making our streets safer and to prioritizing accessibility for every Portlander. Today, I want to celebrate the diversity of people with disabilities. Thank you for being here, and thank you for pushing us to do better. It's our job to meet your needs. To everyone who is blind or visually impaired, you're welcome here, and we continue to work to protect you as we experience our right-of-way together. I want to thank my constituent relations specialist, Ocean Yali, for helping on this item. And now I'm going to turn it over to our guest speakers, Autumn Schaefer and Mary Lee Turner.
Hello. Hi. Thank you, Commissioner Udaly.
Welcome.
We are very grateful that you have invited us to participate, and we've worked hard on, you know, creating awareness and opportunities for people to understand the pedestrian safety issues related to the blind community. And I do want to say that there's a committee called the Pedestrian Safety Action Coalition, and we have put together an incident survey relating to people in our community who are blind and low vision, and the incidents that in the survey has basically shown that the incident rate is significantly higher for the blind community to have vehicle and bicycle incidents while trying to travel safely in the street. So we do want to make sure that people understand the crossing law as it relates to the blind community, which is that when a person who is about to cross or has stepped out onto the curb, or their cane has stepped out or their guide dog has stepped out, no matter where they are, they have the right of way everywhere and anytime. And so it's important, you know, that vehicles, bicyclists, scooter riders, everyone is aware of that and can pay attention to keep people safe.
Thank you.
Good morning. This is Mary Lee Turner, and I have the honor of standing in the position of chairing the Advisory Coalition, Portland Advisory Coalition. And we invite you to join us on not only October 15th, which is National White Cane Safety Day, but to make every day White Cane Safety Day. Unfortunately, the only rights that we as pedestrians are guaranteed are the last rights. And that's, you notice I'm not laughing. If you've ever been struck by a car or a bicycle or even somebody on a scooter, it is a very serious situation. And I, as a native Oregonian, love living here in Portland, and the committee is committed to creating safe spaces for everyone, so that walking is a right that we can all enjoy together. So the Portland Sunday Parkway through PBOT has a website that you can check out. And there's all kinds of things going on this month of October to acknowledge and celebrate White Cane Safety Day. So thank you.
Thank you. Mayor, I think we're moving on to the proclamation now.
which I'll be reading?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Mary and Autumn. I will now read the proclamation. Whereas blindness or visual impairment affects persons from infancy through old age, and whereas people who are blind or visually impaired enjoy all of the rights, benefits, and privileges of living, working, playing, and traveling in this great city of Portland, and whereas white canes and guide dogs are tools that people who are blind or visually impaired use to identify themselves and to travel independently while enjoying these rights, benefits, and privileges, and whereas people of all ages who are blind or visually impaired have the right to travel safely while conducting their business of living, and whereas October 15th has been designated as a day of education and celebration of the advent of white canes and guide dogs for independent and safe travel, and whereas this great city of Portland calls upon public officials, members of civic organizations, and all people in the city of Portland to join together as we work to ensure the benefits and privileges of life in our great city are available to persons who are blind or visually impaired. Now, therefore, I, Chloe Daly, Portland City Commissioner, on behalf of Ted Wheeler, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim October 15th, 2020, to be White Cane Safety Day in Portland and encourage all residents to observe this day.
Yay. And yeah. I do have on a t-shirt that says, stop, it's the law.
That's good. That's great. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Commissioner Daly. Thank you, everybody. And that's great. And it's very important that we remember that. So thank you. Mm-hmm. Next up, Keelan, is item number 796, Time Certain, also a proclamation.
10:46 a.m. For soon. Start to join a meeting button.
Mary, put your phone on mute, please.
You got it. 796, please, Keelan.
Proclaim October 12th, 2020, Indigenous Peoples Day.
Colleagues, next Monday, October 12th, is Indigenous Peoples Day. In 2015, City Council passed a resolution declaring the second Monday of every October as Indigenous Peoples Day. It's my pleasure to welcome this year's guest presenters. Thank you all for joining us today. We really appreciate it. I'll now invite the city's Tribal Relations Director, Laura John, to kick things off. Director John, please take it away and welcome.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Commissioners Hardesty, Fritz, Udaly, and Ryan for the time this morning. I'm happy to be here to bring forward some guest speakers to talk more about this year's Indigenous Peoples Day Proclamation. To formally introduce myself, my name is Laura John. I'm a descendant of the Blackfeet and Seneca Nations, and I'm honored to serve the City of Portland as your Tribal Relations Director. This proclamation is an opportunity to celebrate and recognize the beauty, strength, and humanity that is at the core of Indigenous cultures, all of which are very needed at this time. Today's council item reaffirms the commitment made by the city to support tribal people that live, work, and visit Portland, as well as to establish firm and positive relationships with tribal nations in the region. I would like to bring forward that this is also a time to honor the descendants of survivors of genocide as Indigenous people who resisted attempts to eradicate their culture and connection with the land, their languages, and the traditional ways that were handed down to us by our ancestors. Our relatives in the past stood up against a system that set out to eliminate this knowledge and connection. Indigenous people around the world, including here in Portland, continue to hold this stance to this day because the system of oppression continues. I appreciate the city for its commitment to tribal relations program, including this type of proclamation. Indigenous Peoples Day is a time to celebrate and to be thankful to those who continue to carry their traditional ways of life and to remind us that we all must make the changes needed to stop the continued attempts to eliminate our existence. As each of you know, 2020 has brought to the forefront the importance of recognizing and uplifting the voices, visibility, and experience of the Black community and to begin the process of reconciliation, healing, and work to dismantle a systemic institutional racism. This year's proclamation includes recognition of the vibrant Afro-Indigenous community that resides here in Portland, alongside those who are the first peoples of this, other first peoples of this land base and Indigenous people globally. This movement includes Portlanders who are of Black and Indigenous ancestry, and we'll also be sharing about the impact that COVID-19 has had on tribal people in the region. I would now like to bring forward and introduce our first speaker, a young woman who was born and raised here in the Portland Native community. I've known her whole life. I grew up with her parents, and I'm just so proud of the young woman that she's growing into, and would like to now introduce Apache Robertson.
Hi. Hello and good morning. My name is Apache from Robertson Lopez. I am an Afro-Indigenous youth. I am Choctaw, Apache, and Mami. I am a junior at De La Salle North Catholic High School and a member of the Seven Waters Canoe family. Being an Afro-Indigenous female personally is amazing. There's so much to be thankful for, so much to learn every day. I have faced some issues specifically at school. It's hard being a person of color having all white teachers that don't get where I'm coming from or don't understand why I push myself harder than others to make it to where I want to go. I get treated differently because of the color of my skin and for who I am as an Afro-Indigenous youth. It's hard trying to fit in and be myself when I have to live under an unfair system in the city of Portland. Being under the PPS curriculum is probably one of the biggest challenges for me because I don't agree with it, nor do I put up with the whitewashed version of my people's history. There's so much more that non-POC can learn and really understand if being taught the true history. Given what this world has come to now with the Black Lives Matter movement, the city of Portland and PPS can really learn from it all and take the time to listen to what we have to say. Given the fact that we are people of color and put up with a lot of disrespect and our family members being taken away from us too soon, how will you, being in power, change what this world has come to, giving us, the people, equal rights? How will you help the heavy cases of racism, given the fact that we do live in the most racist city, in the most racist state in the United States alone? All that we ask as Native, Black, and Afro-Indigenous people is to be heard and treated with equal rights as the whites. We are Black, Indigenous, and Afro-Indigenous every day, and every day we face a challenge. One day of acknowledgement is not enough, but it's a start to a big change. We are human beings just like you, and we deserve to have the same respect and rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Apache. I'd like to now introduce our next speaker, Marcela Alcantar, to speak about her work to support Indigenous people from Mesoamerica here in Portland.
Thank you. Ta webikame, miti huwiyani. Members of the Council, thank you for the time and space to share today on Indigenous Day Proclamation. The Creator's blessings. Good morning. I'm a Wichichin Wirarika, Indigenous woman. My mother was a single mother at the age of 14, and she worked as a farm worker for a good part of her life. My ancestors were miners, and many of them and their children died from fumes and gases from the colonization. Today, I'm the owner of president of Alcantara and Associates, a construction company, and also a co-founder of Tayeraidi Tepeye Reyenaidi, a roots need to exist. Tayeraidi's mission is to focus on an Indigenous community-based approach to achieve restorative justice by embracing an ancestor's knowledge and ways to form strong Mesoamerican Indigenous communities partnerships for business development exchange and sharing of culture, spirituality, and mother tongues. Our goals, main goals, include youth capacity and gender-based violence prevention, small business and workforce strategies, biodiversity conservation, culture and art trade programs. However, despite the increase in the interest of indigenous community, sustainability, equity, and social justice, there is still much underrepresentation to have a voice to the invisible people, that is, the indigenous Mesoamerican people and allied brothers and sisters. We're largely disproportionately misrepresented as we remain invisible to social services, education, health, and contracting opportunities due to the inconsistent and intertwined federal definition of Hispanic and Native American. It is essential to work on a viable policy and implementation in order for the state of Oregon and even the nation to comply with Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights with regards to the indigenous Mesoamerican. Inclusion as a protected class in a historical, socially and economically disadvantaged group, and requirements for Tayerari, Tepeye, Reyenari, our roots need to exist. Separe ni u, yate mi adgu, yate mu aneniku, yate kari tapareriku, aki ru, yanikate tune, yate kari puka, reyerari, ubamiruari, Mesoamericanos, teku, reyari radi tu, tepu, uba, tenamikatuku, teku, teruaru, watu ga, madu, ruyu ya yua, uba, mitua, iwayani. Niuki, Mati Watu, Manateku, Menieraditu, Temu Uwayama, Miku, Tayunanitu, Tayerurao, Teneta Yerari Kaku, Tayerari, Tete Tutam, Teta Tutam Maniyaniku, Pampario. Gracias. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcella. And thank you for bringing your indigenous language to today's presentation. It's so beautiful to hear those words. Finally, I'd like to introduce Sue Stewart from the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board that's going to speak specifically about the impact that tribes are facing this year with COVID-19.
Lukuya Mahan Kui Badakat Sustuard Mahan Kuyadan Iite. My friends, I am called Susie Stewart. I am a citizen of the Cow Creek people. I'm the daughter of Luella Rondo Odell and Daryl Eugene Odell, the granddaughter of George Gans Rondo and Theora Pauline Rondo, the great granddaughter of Susan Emmeline McGinnis and Marcellus Rondo. Mayor Wheeler, I serve the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board and the 43 tribes of the Northwest. I'm the Community Health Aid Program Project Director and the Oregon Tribes Liaison to the Health Board's Incident Command Team. I want to take a moment to acknowledge this land that Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board is on. Northwest Area Indian Health Board is located in Multnomah County, Oregon, and rests on the traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Cathlamet, and Clackamas bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Malala, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia River. Our tribe's economic stability is fragile and has been greatly taxed during this time of COVID. Tribal councils had to make hard decisions to shut down government offices, clinics, businesses, and casinos. Tribes experience a dual impact. It is not only tribal citizens that are affected, it is the general community that the tribes employ as well. Healthcare provisions are foundational to our treaty rights. The U.S. government has never fully funded the IHS. Tribes must supplement citizens' unmet healthcare and other needed services with tribal income. The health of our people is at risk. We experience a higher rate of COVID, and for those who become infected, their health outcomes are worse. The mental health impact is compounded by the uncertainty of COVID, food insecurities, housing, and unemployment. Furthermore, with each season, we are missing our ceremonies and those traditional gatherings that bring us together and support our resiliency, our mental health. We miss the healing of a hug from a family member or old friend, but we practice social distancing, wash our hands, and wear our masks. Disparities and inequities associated with social and environmental determinants of health continue to impact our people. You must understand that most reservations are located in rural areas, and there are unintended consequences that are not evidenced in larger metropolitan areas. We hear about delayed and denied care, leading to poor outcomes or even death. Our people have concerns about vaccine testing. Our people must be included in the test trials. Our people must be included in the vaccine planning for distribution and dispensing. Tribes remember 2009 and the H1N1 pandemic and being denied the respect to identify our own priority populations for vaccine. Policy inequities and failures must stop. We want this city to recognize these things. We want this city to advocate for improvements. Zapote, blessings. Blessings to you all. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Sue. Mayor Wheeler and City Commissioners, today I was honored to bring these guest speakers forward and thank them for coming. It's always good to have opportunity to bring tribal voices into council meetings. Thank you, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners, for supporting the city's tribal relations program that assists to address all of the issues that have been brought up today. And also to work to essentially make every day a recognition of Indigenous people in the city's policies, programs, and services provided. This concludes today's presentation.
Thank you, Director John. And now it's my pleasure to read the proclamation. But before I did that, I wanted to ask if any of my colleagues had any comments that they would like to make first. Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. Oh, yes. American history glorifies European colonists while diminishing and misrepresenting the genocide of the Indigenous people who have called this land home since time immemorial and erasing their survival and continued existence. Replacing Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day offers a chance to correct the record, raise awareness, and build understanding. And at a time when our federal administration has characterized racial sensitivity training as anti-American, this celebration is more important than ever. As a third generation Italian American, I take no pride in the legacy of Christopher Columbus or our country's racist foundation based on genocide and slavery. The movement to reinvent this holiday works to correct Indigenous people's erasure. This holiday acknowledges our country's settler colonial history and recognizes and celebrates Indigenous people's history and cultures. Portland has a thriving urban Indigenous community, and Indigenous leaders and organizations are charting the way to a better future for all of us. So thank you to Lord John, the Tribal Relations Office, and the Mayor's Office for putting this proclamation together. Let this day be a reminder of whose land we are on.
Thank you, Commissioner Udaly. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to take a moment and thank our speakers for being here today. I wish we were in council chambers today because, as always, I love the colors and the reflection that is so ingrained in Native culture. And I miss that today. I just want to say that as a personal thing. I also want to applaud the young woman who spoke first. Clearly, that is a young woman who is really committed to cultural understanding making sure that she walks through this world the same way that white people walk through this world. She has been stopped in ways that have nothing to do with her talent, her spirit, and the gifts that she has to give to our community. So what I hope is that we continue to uplift her and let her know that she's valued and that she's at the right place at the right time. Lord John, let me just reiterate the incredible work that you continue to do with such a tiny staff. We're going to help you with that a little bit, but I know that you are everywhere trying to do everything, and it is a mark of your spirit and your value system that you are able to bring so many different people together so that we are all in this together. I think one of the things this pandemic has taught us is that none of us are immune to this pandemic, but many of us who continue to suffer inequitable outcomes are exacerbated by this pandemic. And we just can't hold that up enough because it reminds us that we have a lot more work to do before we as Portlanders can call ourselves a city that's welcoming and fair and equitable to all. So thank you all for being here. And thank you, Mayor, for working on this proclamation. And I agree, Indigenous Peoples Day is 365 days a year, but we're just happening to be acknowledging it now and replacing it with and replacing a day that very few people in America celebrated anyway. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Ryan.
Yes, thank you, Laura John, and members of the Indigenous Native American community in Portland who came forward today. It's so important for us to take a moment to pause, and I agree with what my colleagues have said, and I appreciate Mayor Wheeler's leadership in the hiring of you, Ms. John, and also making sure this is called out at our meeting. There's so much work to be done, and I think for me, my life experience has been in the education space, just really becoming aware of the vast undercounting in the Native American community. And I want to make sure when we look at our data that we always know that it's vastly undercounted when you look at the Native American Indigenous data. And I also, on a personal note, want to say that I grew up with, we called each other brothers and sisters because we played together growing up. I'm the youngest of eight, and there was a family of 14 in the Tsleil-Waututh tribe. And I am grateful for that life experience. They allowed me to be checked often on the whitewashing I was receiving in my curriculum. And I look to you, Sue Stewart, because my niece actually works with you at the American Indian Board, Ticey Mason, and she wanted me to say that, so I get to be a proud uncle at this moment. Anyway, thank you so much for being here and for us taking time to acknowledge a day that we celebrate every day of the year. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you very much to the honored speakers who've shared their wisdom with us today. When we're in council chambers, we sometimes talk about honored guests, and I have learned that, in fact, we are the guests, and you honor us with your presence and with allowing us to share the space and to work to share the power. And I appreciate the focus on substance and the things that need to be done, particularly during the pandemic and always. And I thank you. This is my last celebration of this event, that this moment, because as Apache pointed out, it's not a one day. It's always, it's lives, it's generations, it's this land, it's time immemorial. And so thank you for all of the work that you have graciously done with me over 12 years to inform me of the things that I didn't know, and that I have greatly appreciated knowing now, even recognizing there's so much more that I don't. And so thank you to Laura John for your work to help educate all of us. We do have the opportunity to expand the Tribal Relations Program, and I know that we're all committed to doing so. It's been an absolute honor to have initiated that awakening process at the city, along with Patty Howard, who was on my staff and who brought the issue to my attention. So thank you so much, and we will continue to work with it. I'm now back in charge of Portland Parks and Recreation, and there's renewed interest in many communities over changing the name of some of our our parks that are named for reprehensible people. And we're going to be establishing a process where once again, we're going to ask for your wisdom and your guidance. And we want to work with Indigenous people and Native communities to make sure that we are not burdening you with our requests, and in fact, that you are able to help shape that process. And so thanks again. There's just so much work to do, and I appreciate that we're all committed to working together to do it. I also appreciate Mayor Wheeler for his firm commitment to this work ongoing. I was going to vote, but I'm not voting on this. I'm just saying I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
We'll register that vote anyway. That's good. And thank you for the kind comments. Marcella, I see you have your hand raised. Was there something else you wanted to add?
Yeah, just, as part of the growing process and restructuring or so forth, it's the understanding that the Indigenous Mesoamerican, it's sometimes missed because of the concept that we belong to the Hispanic group. And there's a lot to do to include the Indigenous Mesoamerican as part of the contracting requirements and participation in, like, in the social justice group that you guys just created, the state. There is not representation, and that's what I'm talking about, misrepresentation and underrepresentation. There is both. So just please, if you can keep your attention also to note that there is Indigenous Mesoamerican. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcel, and we appreciate your participation today, and Sue and Apache and Director John and everybody else. Thank you so much. We always enjoy this day. It's both uplifting and it's also informative, and I hope a lot of people tuning in are also learning as we are. So it's now my pleasure to read a proclamation. If we were actually in the chamber, you could see the proclamation, but this will have to suffice in the meanwhile. It's now my honor on behalf of the entire City Council to read the following proclamation. Whereas the City of Portland recognizes that the Indigenous people of the lands that would later become known as the Americas have occupied these lands since time immemorial. And whereas the City of Portland exists at the confluence of the Willamette and Columbia Rivers, which hold a rich and beautiful history of being home to villages and trade routes to the Indigenous people that have been in relationship with the land long before the westward expansion of European American settlements in this country. And whereas Indigenous people continue to fight passionately for their community, way of life, and the well-being of the land that they've been stewards of since time immemorial. And whereas the City of Portland has a responsibility to oppose the institutional racism impacting Indigenous people who continue to face hardships as a result of centuries of neglectful policies and actions responsible for the present day disproportionate outcomes in health, education, and economic mobility. And whereas the city recognizes that during this year, conditions faced by tribal nations and Indigenous people have been further exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. And whereas the city recognizes the solidarity shown by the Indigenous community for the Black Lives Matter movement and the importance of uplifting the Afro-Indigenous and African Indigenous experience. And whereas on October 7th, 2015, Portland City Council passed a resolution resolving that the City of Portland shall recognize Indigenous Peoples Day on the second Monday of October. And whereas the 2020 Indigenous Peoples Day shall be used to express a commitment to the prosperity and well-being of Indigenous people through city policies, practices, advocacy, and the investments that ensure greater access and opportunity while honoring our nation's Indigenous history and contributions. Now, therefore, I, Ted Wheeler, Mayor of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim October 12, 2020, to be Indigenous Peoples Day in the City of Portland and encourage all residents to observe this important day. Thank you all. And Director John, thank you again for your hard work. We all appreciate it. Thank you all for being here for this important proclamation. And now, Keelan, it looks like we move on to the regular agenda, item number 799 is our next item.
Appoint and reappoint members to the Fair Housing Advocacy Committee for terms to end September 30, 2022.
The Fair Housing Advocacy Committee is the multi-jurisdictional committee tasked with review of the regional fair housing analysis of impediments to fair housing. This is something we talk about frequently at council. Fair Housing Advocacy Committee members rise above their individual interests and affiliations to take and review the barriers the Portland community faces in regard to accessing both fair and equitable housing. The appointments today fill vacancies on the committee with individuals who are committed to addressing the pressing fair housing issues and needs of residents of Portland and give us a diversity of opinions and experiences. Thank you, Ashley Miller, Rachel Nace, Lauren Wade, Taylor Smiley Wolf, Ada Jimenez, Alan Lazo, Barbara Geyer, Becky Strauss, Bryn Council, Dong Ho, Ellen Toland, Holly Stevens, Jay Rutherford Tai, Maria Romero, Marisa Espinosa, and Vera Warren for your willingness to serve on the Fair Housing Advocacy Committee. We absolutely appreciate it, and I look forward to your guidance as committee members. And with that, I will turn it over to Kim McCarty. She's our Rental Services Office Manager, and she'll present the report. And again, thank you all for being willing to step up for this important assignment.
Mayor, members of council, for the record, Matthew Schaubold with the Portland Housing Bureau, because Kim is now the executive director of the Community Alliance of Tenants.
Sorry, Matt, my notes weren't updated, but I know who you are. Welcome. Thank you.
The appointments got delayed. We were hoping to get this in before she left. But so the mayor introduced the committee. I'll just add that this is one of our five permanent advisory bodies and a critical part of our work, particularly since we are about to embark on our new five-year consolidated plan and our new analysis of impediments and identifying action to take to further fair housing in Portland, Multnomah County, and with the city of Gresham. And so I am just going to walk through, I'll facilitate all of our members having an opportunity just to introduce themselves and share a few remarks with council, and the Bureau is very appreciative of the volunteers stepping forward with their expertise and time to help us as we work to improve our rental housing landscape and fair housing in the Multnomah County area. So I will begin with Alan Lazo.
Thank you, Matt, and good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Alan Lazo. I'm the Executive Director of the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. And I'll just say a few words. I was told I had a little bit of extra time, so I'll go ahead and take that on. I just first want to start out by really saying how much I've appreciated working with the past members of the Fair Housing Advocacy Committee that have served over the years, and also with the Bureau and the other consortium members on this important work around fair housing. I'll remind us that the work of fair housing is focused on upholding the rights of members of protected classes, which at the federal level include race, color, national origin, religion, sex, disability, and familial status, and also adds at the state level protections for source of income, including voucher holders, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Right now, we're reminded that this work has become vitally important as we're at the crossroads of a number of pandemics now, and I don't know what the next one is around the corner. Whether it's the COVID-19 health crisis, the racial injustice crisis, and now the climate change crisis at our doorsteps. We know that members of these protected classes that have experienced a history of housing discrimination and segregation, this history has laid bare the vulnerabilities that inequitable community development has created. Our committee's work, FHEC's work in the past, I think it's fair to say, has been quite a ride. from dealing with numerous local issues and confronting housing discrimination and equal access to housing, to also contending with the shifting landscape of mandates around affirmatively furthering fair housing and the expectation of jurisdictions like consortium members of PHB, Multnomah County, Gresham, and Home Forward. But I'm here to say this morning that work of fair housing goes far beyond a federal mandate. And it really reflects our shared values as a community of open and inclusive communities. And those community mandates for us to address racial segregation in housing and ensure equal access to housing for all Portlanders. We've seen quite clearly in the current calls for racial justice for our leaders to strengthen their commitments to fair housing among our local jurisdictions from groups like Reimagine Oregon. So that tells me again that I see the work of FHAC as not only overseeing this federal mandate of the analysis of impediments, which moves into the consolidated plan, but is that place where we can work together to bring engagement and accountability around these vitally important racial justice and housing issues that our community so clearly is calling for. And I'm looking forward to continuing to work and serve with my fellow members of FHAC in that capacity and with all of the consortium members that are coming here to the table to hear these important messages. And so it's with that commitment to our shared values as Portlanders that I'm excited to continue bringing my involvement in the Fair Housing Advocacy Committee. So thank you so much for having me here this morning.
Thank you, Alan, and thank you for helping to set the stage. And so now I'm gonna quickly move through our other advisory body members and ask them to introduce themselves. So next I have Aida Jimenez.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for having me here today. My name is Ayla Jimenez. I am currently the asset manager at Hacienda CDC. I'm an Oregon native and have lived a majority of my life in Northeast and North Portland. So I'm very eager to be part of this committee and look forward to different projects and assignments that we'll be tackling on in the months ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Barbara Geyer. We have Barbara.
Hi, I'm sorry. This is Barbara Geyer. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon since 2005. I am a licensed real estate principal broker in Oregon since 2005. And I'm also licensed in California, and that began way back in 1977. I am a woman of color. When I was young, there were no fair housing laws. Housing discrimination, redlining, and blockbusting were common. Applications for mortgages from qualified buyers were routinely denied. Though my family owned our own home, many were unfairly barred. The Fair Housing Act of 1968 and later laws changed lives. I'm proud of my industry, but there's still much work to be done. I'm advocating for, and I believe in, tenants of protected classes must be allowed to assert their housing rights always. Also, home buyers of color need to fair and equal access to all preferential housing financing instruments and be able to live in neighborhoods of their choice. And very soon, I hope, some important legislation in Oregon will pass, and this will require post-licensing fair housing education for us. Yay, I've been advocating for this. So thank you so much for appointing me to the Fair Housing Advocacy Committee, and I'm so pleased for your support. Thanks.
Thank you. Rin, are you there?
Good morning. Yes, thank you. My name is Bryn Council. My pronouns are she, her. I am the Director of Housing and Advocacy Programming at Insights Young Parent Services, which is a Janus youth program. I'm really grateful and excited for this opportunity to be a part of some much needed change in the community. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. Young Ho.
Hello. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Yung Ho, and my pronouns are she, her, hers, and I am the Tenant Education and Support Director at Community Alliance of Tenants. I've been doing housing advocacy work for the last 12 years, and I hope to bring a perspective to the FHAC committee as a person who's been doing housing advocacy work on behalf of renters across Oregon, as well as being a daughter of refugees and working with a diverse and immigrant refugee community. Thank you.
Thank you. Ellen Toland.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Ellen Toland. I use she, her pronouns. I work for Transition Projects as a housing case manager, where I work with individuals to overcome barriers faced by our houseless community to ensure safe, stable, and sustainable housing. I chose to be part of this advocacy committee because I think it's important to acknowledge those barriers faced by our fellow community members, whether that be systemic racism, financial inequality, disability, or other stigma and barriers. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thank you. Holly Stevens.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me. My name is Holly Stevens. I am currently a project manager for Rise Partnership, working with home care and personal support workers. I have done a lot of work in the community of North and Northeast Portland, working with youth and families over the last about four years now. So I'm really excited about being a part of this committee and working towards our mission and making things better for people who live in those communities.
Thank you. Jamila Rutherford-Tai.
Hello, my name is Jamila Rutherford-Tai. I go by Jay. I'm originally a Portland native. I grew up in Northeast Portland, and I moved away when I was 18 and lived in seven cities across the nation in neighborhoods that were all gentrifying. And so I have a personal passion about fair housing. I'm also a conflict resolution equity, work on racial equity at Resolutions Northwest. And I'm really excited. I'm a huge out of the box thinker. I'm all about being creative and not, and you know, completely busting the wheel. I hate the statement, why do we have to reinvent the wheel? I think we should destroy the wheel and make something amazing and better. So I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Lauren Wade.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me. My name is Lauren Wade. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I'm a program specialist senior in the housing stability team from Multnomah County. I'm really excited to be joining the committee today and look forward to continuing to build deeper alignment with county programs and services and to support and affirmatively further fair housing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mara Romero.
Good morning. My name is Mara Romero. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I am here representing Independent Living Resources, where I serve as an independent living specialist and their lead housing advocate. ILR is an organization of people with disabilities serving people with disabilities. We are very proud of that fact. I'm honored to be a part of this committee, and I hope to contribute my extensive personal and professional knowledge of disability rights to the committee, as well as a deep understanding of the specific obstacles local disabled community members face in accessing safe and affordable housing. Thank you.
Thank you. Marisa Espinoza.
Hi, everybody, and Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Marisa Espinosa. I use she and her pronouns, and I'm the Public Policy Coordinator for Northwest Pilot Project. Thank you for this opportunity. Northwest Pilot Project provides housing stabilization, case management, and other housing assistance to older adults who are age 55 and up and in Multnomah County. And I'm really grateful to be a new member and to participate in this opportunity. I joined in part because of the passion I grew for fair housing as a case manager for 5 years with Northwest Pilot Project, seeing firsthand any impediments to fair housing, especially for 0-30 AMI renters. I know more of us seem to be recognizing that mass homelessness is deeply rooted in structural racism, racial segregation, and racist housing policy. And I just want to note that in the next 10 years, the number of older adults experiencing homelessness is expected to triple. And Black and Indigenous and people of color are very overrepresented in this group. So overall, I'm just very excited to contribute to ongoing efforts to enforce fair housing protections for renters in Portland. Thank you.
Finally, Taylor Smiley Wolf.
Good afternoon, Mayor Wheeler and members of the Portland City Council. My name is Taylor Smiley Wolf. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I am the Director of Policy and Planning at Home Forward, which is the housing authority for Multnomah County. As you know, we administer the Housing Choice Voucher Program in the county, and after many households wait for a very long time to receive their voucher, essentially winning the lottery for a subsidy that should be an entitlement, they too often face discrimination due to source of income that creates barriers to achieving fair housing. So I look forward to working on this committee for that reason, and also to participate in local leadership to advance racial equity and affirmatively furthering fair housing in light of our federal government abdicating its responsibility to do those things with the gutting of the affirmatively furthering fair housing rule. Thank you so much.
Thank you to all of our volunteers and advisory committee members. Mayor Wheeler.
Thank you. This is an impressive slate of candidates, and Matt and Shannon, thank you so much for your hard work, and I appreciate the comments that you've all made, and I know we're going to get to know all of you better and hear from you more in the years ahead. Thank you for your willingness to step forward. You all have really impressive backgrounds, and I know there's 1,000 other things you could possibly be doing, and it really honors all of us in this community that you're willing to step forward and help us with this important issue of fair housing. So thank you all. Colleagues, if you have any further comments, Commissioner Daly, I see your hand is raised.
I'll just give my comments at closing.
All right, you wanna make a motion?
So moved.
Okay, we have a motion from Commissioner Daly to accept the report, a second from Commissioner Hardesty. Any further discussion before we call the roll? Seeing none, Keelan, please call the roll.
You, Daly.
Well, I'm just so thrilled and impressed with this slate of nominees who represent so many communities that are disparately and adversely impacted by our housing crisis, and bring both lived experience and professional experience to the role. I just, I wanna say that despite the Trump administration's undermining of our fair housing rules, that I still consider affirmatively furthering fair housing as a moral imperative, and that I'm deeply committed to that work. I want to acknowledge Alan Lazo and the Fair Housing Council of Oregon's contribution to the Fair Access and Renting Ordinance, which my office developed hand in hand with community and passed last year. FAIR is now being considered as a national model for combating housing discrimination. And I'm really proud of the work that we did with community to move that item. We know that in times of housing instability, protected classes are impacted first and worst and face the highest barriers to housing. I know that the Fair Housing Advocacy Committee's work has been on hold for a while, so I'm so grateful to see the work reconvening with these amazing members and diving into this critical work. I vote aye.
Fritz.
Thank you, everybody, for your willingness to serve, and in particular, thank you, Alan Lazo, for your leadership at the Fair Housing Council over many years. I've really appreciated your dedication, your advice, and your attention to equity from long ago. So thank you. This will be my last time to vote to reappoint or appoint members, and I'm happy to do so. Aye.
Ryan.
Yes, thank you for that great presentation. I had no idea you were maybe idle for a while, but what a bang that you just came out with today with this impressive slate of engaged volunteers. And so thank you for your service. I really want to call out one person in particular. You go by Jay. I like that you mentioned how many cities you've lived in and what you've experienced in your life with gentrification. I think it's great when people bring that national perspective to this issue. And I also really want to acknowledge that you use data to make your decisions. And I look forward to wonking out with you on that. And so we can make sure we have informed decisions by evidence. And anyway, appreciate all of you. Bye.
Christy.
Yes, I sorry, I was like giggling because Commissioner Ryan talked about geeking out on data. So he doesn't know yet just how much Mayor Wheeler and I geek out on data on a regular basis. It just makes the blood just like percolate. I want to thank you very much. This is an extremely impressive list of community volunteers who come from a whole lot of different backgrounds and lived experiences, each which will bring their own unique perspective to this work. And also don't want to miss the opportunity to really appreciate the hard work Commissioner Udaly has done and making sure that housing and protecting renters in their homes is a corner piece of the work that we do. All of us know that with this pandemic, our housing, our lack of housing people can afford to live in is only going to be exacerbated. And so I want to just really applaud folks who are stepping up to actually help us go through this minefield that we are about to enter. I also wanna thank Alan, who, oh my gosh, Alan, you've been doing this work for probably longer than I've been alive. I'm just joking. You've been doing this work for decades. And I am very grateful that you continue to bring the same enthusiasm, the same centeredness, and the same commitment to justice that you brought from day one. And so I am very happy to vote aye.
Wheeler.
Yeah, well, thank you for outing us there, Commissioner Hardesty. When we all look in the mirror in the morning, what we see is rugged individualists, but what we know we've got going on here is a total nerd fest. So Jay, welcome to the team. You're gonna fit in just great. Alan, I don't know where you're getting the time to serve on all of these important community boards and commissions and everything else, but more power to you. I think it's great. And Taylor, you have the best background today. She just went dark on me right as I said that. It's reminding me of one of the reasons we all love this community is because we really do have such an incredible proximity to some just a world-class nature areas, and it brings a lot of people from all over the country and all over the world. But at the end of the day, we want to be, and we must be, an open, welcoming, and inclusive city. And right now, given just all of the economic anxiety and the turmoil, housing is front and center. And there are laws, there are rules, and fair housing is one of the most important principles embedded in the values around housing in this community. And I don't think we could put together a better slate of people to help us navigate with some pretty complex territory. So thanks again, all of you. My hat's off to you. And I'm happy to vote aye. The report is accepted and you are all confirmed. Thank you for your service to the community. Our next item looks like it's 800, Office of Management and Finance. Speaking of Nerdfest, 800.
Accept bid of Kodiak Pacific Construction Co. for the East Portland Access to Employment and Education Project for $5,628,899.
Colleagues, this procurement report is for a PBOT Vision Zero project that will make safety improvements and enhance access to public transit, schools, and community centers in East Portland. The project is receiving federal funding through the ODOT Federal and Federal Aid Highway Program. It looks like we have the one and only Lester Spittler here to present the report.
Thank you, Mayor Wheeler. Good morning, City Council. For the record, Lester Spittler, the city's chief procurement officer. On September 25th.
Wait a minute, you're not Lester Spittler. We all know what Lester looks like.
Got a haircut. I wasn't sure when I'd be able to
get it. Looks good, man. It looks good. How are you today?
I'm all right. Thank you. Thank you for asking. So council passed ordinance 189707 on September 25th, 2019 to allow procurement services to competitively solicit an invitation to bid for the project. The engineer's estimate was $6,252,907 at the time, and the confidence level was high. We issued the invitation to bid on July 10th, and bids were due on August 11th. We received five bids for the project, which is good amount of competition. Kodiak Pacific Construction Company is the responsive and responsible low bidder. Their bid is $5,628,898.98, which is just shy of 10% under the engineer's estimate. As Mayor Wheeler said, this is a federal aid transportation project under the ODOT Federal Aid Highway Program. In 2011, Council passed Ordinance Number 179568, which authorized PBOT to participate in ODOT's local agency certification program for the delivery of federal aid high projects. Under ODOT certification, this project will be reviewed and audited by ODOT for federal aid compliance. And as such, the city's subcontractor equity program and our workforce training and hiring program do not apply. Instead, ODOT will be administering their disadvantaged business enterprise program, equal employment opportunity, and on-the-job training programs. ODOT establishes the minimum disadvantaged business enterprise goals for each federal aid project in compliance with Title 49 of the Code of Federal Regulations, Part 26, which is participation by disadvantaged business enterprises in the Department of Transportation Financial Assistance Programs. ODOT is an agency that conducts disparity studies to inform its goals. The criteria used in assigning project goals includes project location, size, duration, and the availability of firms that can perform identified subcontracting opportunities. ODOT set the DBE goal at 12%. Kodiak Pacific Construction is responsive to the 12% goal and is committed to using 12.17% of DBE firms. They're listed in the report in the areas of survey work, signs and traffic control, flagging, and trucking. It's also noteworthy that Kodiak Pacific Construction is a state-certified women-owned business enterprise that does not contribute to the goal because ODOT, as a federal agency, only acknowledges the disadvantaged business enterprise certification. The ownership of Kodiak Pacific is a white female. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them. If not, I'd recommend acceptance of the report and authorization to execute the contract.
Commissioner Hardesty has her hand up. Thank you, Lester.
Thank you, Lester. Thank you, Mayor. Lester, are there any city dollars involved in this contract?
I'd have to look to someone from PBOT to help answer that question. I'm not sure of the funding sources that are being used.
I ask that question is when we talk about building minority businesses and 14,000 is this total contract? 14,000 of a $5.6 million contract goes to an African-American woman-owned flagging company. I just got disgusted looking at the breakdown. And the excuse that the city has no authority to do anything, I reject that. If we're putting any city dollars in it, we have the ability to actually have an input on that. Nobody could look at this and say there's anything fair about the subcontracting opportunities that are presented in this contract. So I'll leave it there. We'll have a longer conversation about how city contracts in a couple of weeks, I believe. Is somebody from PBOT or ODOT on the phone to answer this question? PBOT, actually, I want to know how much city dollars are going into this project.
I'm trying to determine that right now, Commissioner.
Thank you.
If anyone's on the call right now, can you just speak up and answer Commissioner Hardesty's questions? And if not, I have a text out to staff.
So I'll just say, if there's no one to answer this question today, I just can't imagine me ever supporting this proposal. It is not the direction the city of Portland is going, and we cannot hide behind the state's minimum qualifications to justify us continuing down this road of not making contracting opportunities available for African American, Indigenous, and other people of color.
Commissioner, I share your disappointment and frustration, but I was advised by staff that we had no ability to compel them to strive for higher DBE requirements. But I would really love to get staff on the line to address that question.
Years, right? About our limits, and I'm not accepting it anymore.
It's all that's fine to not accept it, but it is driven by who is funding the project. And
could I suggest this, Commissioner Daly? This is just a first reading. Oh, I'm sorry, it's a report. Never mind. I'll stop talking. So let me just ask a slightly different question on this, and maybe Lester can answer it. So. And I understand Commissioner Hardesty's question about whether or not there are matching dollars from the local level from PBOT going into this project. But I just want to understand the core argument here that you're making, Lester, is that the DBE requirements here under the federal contract are, that is a federal standard in order to secure federal dollars for this project. Is that the argument you're making, or am I getting that wrong?
No, that's correct. Through that certification process that was passed in 2011, we essentially become sort of a pass-through agency of ODOT for projects that are within our jurisdiction. So we're sort of a contracting agency of theirs to perform their construction projects. And they obviously receive federal dollars from the Department of Transportation through the Federal Highway Administration.
Okay. Okay, and I see that. That was back in 11. So ODOT basically said that PBOT had successfully completed the requirements to become certified, and we then certified under their standards in order to receive federal dollars for projects like this.
Right.
Okay, I see. I got it.
Mayor, if I can't get anyone on the line, I'm going to suggest that we maybe move this to the end of today's session, because I'd also like clarity on this issue.
Yeah, that makes sense. And if nobody has any objections, we'll move it to the end of the agenda, and we'll get somebody on the horn from PBOT. And if somebody, Keelan, if you could just remind me at the end so I don't adjourn us without coming back to this issue, I'd appreciate it.
Okay.
Very good. So then we'll move on to the next item, which is the 801, that is a second reading.
Approve application under the Multiple Unit Limited Tax Exemption Program under the Inclusionary Housing Program for codes on North Interstate located at 5460 North Interstate Avenue.
Colleagues, this is a second reading. We've already heard a presentation. We had a lively discussion on this and the next item. We took public testimony. Is there any further discussion on this issue? I see two hands raised, but I think those are old hand raises. So with that, call the roll.
You, Daly.
You're muted, Commissioner.
Okay. This is 801?
Yeah, correct. 801.
All right.
You're muted again.
I don't know what's happening.
The computer does not love you today. There you go.
This ordinance brought to the surface long simmering concerns with our affordable housing requirements. 80% AMI rent is not affordable for far too many Portlanders. These regulated affordable studios could conceivably cost more than market rate units on North Interstate. The development is walking distance from the Yellow Line and PCC Cascade. If this development was in East Portland, market rate rents would be even more out of line with the affordable rents. So I'm going to suggest today that we need to take a closer look at our IH requirements. We need to look at our income level requirements and make sure we're requiring units that are affordable for the neighborhoods they're being built in. if we're seeing units where regulated rents come in at or above market rent, that means our requirements are too lax or at least not nuanced enough. And we've already discussed in the past how we need to look at unit reconfiguration to make sure that when we get a family-sized unit, it is actually family-sized and developers aren't just squeezing in extra bedrooms to an existing floor plan. I am voting for this ordinance because the alternative is to lose all 23 price-controlled units in this development. And the, you know, at the end of the day, the city is still getting back much more in rent reductions than we're giving in tax abatement, which is my bottom line with this, with inclusionary housing. So while the rents for affordable studios were alarming, or potential rents were alarming in these times, in time, these units will fall below market rent and remain affordable for 99 years. And I really don't want to lose that opportunity. This development is a wake-up call, though, and inclusionary housing is a critical and much-needed policy to solving our housing affordability crisis. While we've seen some promising results with our current requirements, I believe it's time to recalibrate. We need to take a second look and make sure we're setting requirements that deliver the affordable units that we need. I vote aye.
Fritz?
I share the sentiments that Commissioner Daly just expressed. We have to get a change in state law to be able to recalibrate and change the requirements. So that needs to be a priority for next year at the legislature. They tied our hands to start off with. I believe staff has done an excellent job of making the best of what we've been allowed to do. Dori Van Brockel in particular has been outstanding. And like Commissioner Daly, I think that the long-term affordability and stability is makes this project worthwhile. Aye.
Ryan.
Yes, thank you. And first I want to acknowledge Commissioner Udaly's comments. They were very helpful. Although it was kind of a curveball at the end when you went on to say you would support this at this time. And I definitely feel like a rookie at the moment trying to take all this in. It's in my neighborhood actually. And so I know that last week when this was brought up, it was quite a head scratcher. It remains a head scratcher. And I hear from my other colleague, Commissioner Fritz, the connection to the state law. And I appreciate that. So I will go with the trust of my colleagues and vote aye.
Hardesty.
This was the very first time that we have been presented with the affordable units costing more than a market rate unit. In my 21 plus months on the city council, I've been extremely frustrated with this program because no one in their right mind believes 80% of median family income is affordable for working people in the city of Portland. I will be voting no on this measure because I am not going to set a precedent where we're going to allow developers to build buildings that one day will be affordable in the future. I just think that's a line I cannot cross. And just as Commissioner Udaly and Commissioner Fritz said, state law notwithstanding, if we as a city continue to allow our developers to pretend that they're building affordable housing units in our city, and we continue to reward them with tax breaks for something that's not affordable, there is no reason why they would change their behavior at all. And so I am an adamant no on this one and will be on anything that costs more when it's supposedly affordable than what the market rate is. I vote no.
Wheeler.
First of all, I want to agree with my colleagues who point out that 80% IMI I would describe that perhaps as workforce housing. It's very, very hard to make the case that is, quote, lower income housing, unquote. I think we're all in complete agreement on that point. And there's an advocacy question there for us in our legislative agenda. as we go to Salem, because after all, these rules were not established by developers. Developers decide whether or not they're going to take advantage of these incentives in exchange for the accepted level of affordability that our legislative colleagues put together. So if we want to change it, it's not the developers we need to talk to, it's our colleagues down in Salem who established this incentive program and put the parameters around it. So that's my first comment. My second comment is I agree with everybody that this raises a lot of questions that within the building itself, the affordable units are priced higher than the market rate units. And I agree that I've never seen anything the likes of this, and it definitely raises questions. But I also acknowledge that the program is not established in terms of pricing within any particular structure. It's dependent upon the market itself, the totality of the market. And I think the argument that the people who created this program that they would make is we are trying to find affordable housing within a market, not necessarily within the confines of any specific project. But it still raises a lot of questions just in terms of why the developer is using this pricing structure. And I think there'll be more to be discussed on that point. And it's one more data point that we should be taking to Salem as we try to true up this program and figure out what the right landing pad is for it. In the meanwhile, I support the multi-program. I believe it could be a better program in terms of affordability. I think there's some inconsistencies that need to be ironed out. This one clearly identifies one of those potential oddities or inconsistencies. But in the absence of this program, the developer is held to no affordability requirements whatsoever. And therefore, based on the totality of the program, I will support this. I vote aye. And the ordinance is adopted. 802, also a multi, also a second reading. Keelan.
Amend approved application under the Multiple Unit Limited Tax Exemption Program under the Inclusionary Housing Program for Markham Hill Apartments, Building 2, located at 3178 Southwest 12th Avenue to increase the number of affordable units.
Second reading. Any further business on this item? Commissioner Daly, you have your hand raised. Please call the roll.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
This is the kind of proposal I can get behind. I vote aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. Next up, item 803, emergency ordinance.
Authorize a contract with Cascade Controls for an emergency procurement and installation of 3 variable frequency drives under project number E11320 for an amount of $266,096.
Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. So I'm going to turn it over to Environmental Services staff. Oh, here we go. I've got these talking points. So Environmental Services operates 99 pump stations that work together with over 2,000 miles of pipes to direct sewage and stormwater to the Columbia Boulevard wastewater treatment plant. Environmental Services has an emergency need to replace all 3 variable frequency devices at the Inverness pump station, one of which has already failed. The Inverness pump station serves about one-third of Northeast Portland. Maintaining reliability of the pump station and the variable VFDs, variable frequency devices, is necessary to prevent a spill during the storm season and to protect public health, property, and the environmental health of the Columbia Slough. Here today with a presentation on this emergency ordinance is Aaron Lawler, Senior Engineer, and Paul Cito, Engineering Manager, both at the Bureau of Environmental Services.
Thank you. Commissioner Fritz, for the introduction. Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and Commissioners. I'm Paul Sudo, Engineering Manager. This is the first of, we actually have 2 presentations on related to the same facility, the Inverness Pump Station, but different asset systems. So I'm here to help answer questions, and Aaron Lawler will be doing the presentation. Thank you.
Hello,
Hello, thank you. This is my first time doing a virtual council, so can you all see the presentation I'm sharing? Great. Hopefully there's no technological hiccups. So my name is Aaron Lawler, senior engineer in the treatment and pumping station, pumping systems division. I manage the pump station improvement program out there. So the Inverness Pump Station is a large critical pump station located in Northeast Portland near Northeast 122nd Avenue and is adjacent to the Columbia Slough. This slide here points out where the pump station is located. It is considered one of the Bureau's backbone pump stations. And it is the sixth largest daily used pump station in the collection system. This pump station serves a large portion of East County and receives flow from approximately 20 other pump stations. It conveys sewage directly to the Columbia Boulevard wastewater treatment plant via two force main systems. On average, it contributes up to 10% of the dry weather flow that Columbia Boulevard receives daily. Here we have a picture of the outside of the pump station. Inverness Pump Station was constructed in 1984 and has had various upgrades and improvements since the initial construction. The pump station uses three large pumps to convey sewage via force main to Columbia Boulevard wastewater treatment plant for treatment. During dry weather, one pump is able to handle the flow at Inverness, but during wet weather events, two pumps are required. A third pump is required by DEQ during wet weather events to provide redundancy should one pump fail. To meet DEQ's level of service requirements, three pumps are required to be operational at the station for the start of the wet weather season in early October. Due to the age of the electrical system and the pump station, the large pumps are not able to be run without a variable frequency drive to start the pumps. Variable frequency drives is a component that controls the speed of the pump motor, allowing the motor to speed up or slow down, which in turn changes the amount of sewage the pumps can pump. This can be helpful or needed for a variety of reasons, including energy efficiency, flow matching, or capacity issues. On June 26, 2020, one of the VFDs at Inverness Pump Station failed, and the pump station was reduced to only two pumps. The anticipated useful life of these variable frequency drives is 12 to 15 years. All three VFDs were installed in 2004 and have experienced similar run times. There's a high risk that another VFD may fail at any moment. Without three operational pumps during the wet weather season, there's a significant risk for pump station surface overflow and discharge to waterways, including the Columbia Slough. An emergency project is required due to the lead time associated with purchasing and manufacturing these large variable frequency drives, as well as the required installation time. Manufacture of these drives requires 6 weeks, while the removal and replacement requires an additional 2 weeks. Due to the lead time and the need to have at least one drive replaced before October 1, 2020, standard project delivery and contracting approaches were not feasible. This slide here provides an overview of what this emergency project is going to do. So we have initiated an emergency project to enter into contract with Cascade Controls, Inc. This company will provide three variable frequency drives for the Inverness pump station, as well as remove the existing drives and replace the new drives. The goal of the project is to complete the installation of one variable frequency drive by the beginning of October to meet our regulatory requirements. And then based on weather windows, we will replace the remaining two VFDs when the opportunity arises over the next several months. This slide right here might be a little hard to see, but that yellow outlined area is the basin that this one pump station serves. So it's quite a significant portion of Portland. So this is a timeline of the project so far. So an emergency declaration was signed by the mayor on July 23rd. We then began working on the scope and getting the contract issued with Cascade Controls, and a purchase order for the drives was ordered on August 7th, and the drives had been manufactured and delivered to the pump station, and we began installation of the first VFD on September 16th, and were able to meet our installation deadline of early October for this first variable frequency drive. And this slide here provides a project budget and schedule. So we are here for this ordinance for a approval of the authorization of a goods and services contract with Cascade Control Inc. for the procurement and installation of the three VFDs at Inverness Pump Station. That contract is valued at $266,096. And as you can see, we're well underway on this project and are making great progress in protecting the waterways. And that is what I have for this presentation. Thank you.
Very good. Colleagues, any questions on this item? And we have, do we have any public testimony, Keelan?
No one signed up for this item.
All right, this is an emergency ordinance. I believe Commissioner Hardesty had to step out for a few minutes, but we still have four of us present. Please call the roll.
You, Daly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Aaron, could you stop sharing your screen, please, because I can't get to my talking points.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Thank you very much. That's all right. I'm a technologically challenged myself. I'm sure there is a way to do it, but... not for me, there isn't. So anyway, I do appreciate the presentation. Thanks to Diane Dolkin of the BES Public Information Officer for preparing my talking points, and staff for your great work. Aye.
Ryan.
Hey, thank you for that thorough presentation, Aaron. Aye.
Hardesty, Wheeler.
I think Commissioner Hardesty may still be on the... Commissioner Hardesty, are you still there with us? No, she stepped out, so I'll go ahead and vote. Thank you for the presentation. It pains me that we have only 99 pump stations. It seems we're just begging for one more somewhere. At any rate, this will do. I appreciate the work. I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. Next item is 804, also BES.
Authorize a contract with Titan Utilities, Inc. for emergency repair of the Inverness Force Main Project number E11325 for an estimated cost of $2,500,000.
Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you. On August 11th, Environmental Services discovered a sinkhole at the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant and determined the cause was the collapse of a portion of the Inverness Pump Station Force Main. The Inverness Force Main carries sewage from a large portion of northeast Portland to the treatment plant. Environmental Services has an emergency need to repair and replace the Force Pipe Main and to build temporary piping to convey wastewater around the 2,100-foot length of the Force Main while repairs are being made. These emergency repairs are needed to protect the safety of city staff at the treatment plant, as well as the public environment by preventing a sewage release from the Force Main. Here today with a presentation on this emergency ordinance is, again, Aaron Lawler, Senior Engineer, and Paul Suto, Engineering Manager, both of the Bureau of Environmental Services.
Okay, thank you again, Commissioner Fritz, for the introduction. I'll just turn it over as Paul Suto, Engineering Manager with BES. I'll turn it over to Aaron Lawler for the presentation. Thank you.
And, make sure I'm sharing my screen again. All right, thank you. So Aaron Lawler, Senior Engineer, Treatment and Pumping Systems Division, manage the Pump Station Improvement Program. So as mentioned in our previous presentation, the Inverness Pump Station is a large critical pump station located in Northeast Portland. The pump station serves a large portion of East Midtownie and receives flow from approximately 20 other pump stations. In fact, it serves nearly 12,000 acres, making Inverness the single largest sewer basin in the city of Portland, and by area, it serves about 15% of Portland. It conveys sewage directly to Columbia Boulevard wastewater treatments plant via force mains. There are two force mains that are approximately 10 miles long, and they combine to a single force main near Columbia Boulevard wastewater treatment plant. That's the section highlighted in red on this slide. That's the force main heading into Columbia Boulevard. The emergency project that brings us here today is to repair and replace the portion of the force main that was highlighted on the previous page.
I'm sorry, somebody just has to say ick or gross or something, so I'll take that prerogative as the presiding officer. Gross.
Yep, this is what we do. Not too gross to us. To do this, the emergency project that brings us here today is to repair and replace the portion of the force main that was highlighted on the previous page. To do this, an emergency contract with a construction contractor is required for the purposes of establishing a temporary bypass force main, conducting condition assessment of the section of the force main that is compromised, and repair and replace the portions of the force main that have failed. The final segment of the Inverness Force Main is approximately 2,100 feet long and is 36 inches in diameter. On August 11th, 2020, near the Force Main discharge location at Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant, a sinkhole was discovered. Investigation into the sinkhole, that's what you see here on this slide, revealed that the 36-inch force main below had catastrophically failed and collapsed on itself. Upstream investigation revealed that other portions of the pipe has collapsed as well. And that's what the Vactor truck is doing in this photo, is going upstream and poking around. Based on review of the force main as-builts, which are drawings that detail how the original force main was built, combined with our understanding of how the system operates, we believe that the final 2,100 feet of the Inverness force main are compromised, have failed, or will fail, and require repair. This is another shot of the failed force main. So the rounded area of dirt is where the pipe used to be, and that's its collapse upon itself below. The Inverness force main receives flow from approximately 20 other pump stations. Modeling indicates that during dry weather situations, Inverness pump station can only be offline for 7 to 9 hours before surface overflows and discharge to waterways may occur. Without a functional force main, the Inverness pump station cannot operate. Without an operational force main, there is an extremely high risk for surface overflow or discharge to waterways, including the Columbia Slough. Upon discovery of the collapsed pipe and understanding that up to 2,100 feet may be in similar condition, it was necessary to mobilize crews immediately to begin installation of the temporary force main to mitigate risk. An emergency project is required due to the severity of the failure and the urgency to respond. We are here today to finalize the construction contract for this emergency work. This is a photo of work in progress. This is the temporary force main that has been constructed to keep the pump station online, and it's discharging just outside of Columbia Boulevard wastewater treatment plant. The first priority of the emergency project was to stabilize the situation. To do this, we requested the services of Titan Utilities, Inc. to collaboratively come up with the quickest solution for establishing a temporary bypass force main. This reduced the risk of additional line failures, as well as reduced the risk of surface overflows or discharge. Following establishment of a temporary force main, Titan Utilities, Inc. and DES engineering staff conducted condition assessment of the existing 2,100 feet of 36-inch line to determine which sections require repair and which require replacement. Titan and DES then proceeded to collaborate through a design-build-like approach to make the necessary repairs. Titan Utilities, Inc. is a participant in the Disadvantaged Minority Women-Owned or Emerging Small Businesses Program. Titan has worked with the city extensively, including on-call emergency contracts, and has past experience working on this exact force main. Because of this, as well as their availability, they were offered the contract. The project has moved very quickly since the initial discovery. We currently have the temporary force main in place, which is working well and has significantly reduced the risk of additional failures. Condition assessment of the existing force main is nearly complete and will guide the final repair approach for the 2,100 feet of pipe. There are a number of options for repair and replacement, and we will work closely with the contractor to determine the best approach. The contract duration is for 6 months, although we are currently ahead of schedule, and it is believed that the repair of the force main will take approximately 3 months. And again, this is a map of Inverness collection system area, quite a major component of our system. So here's a project budget and schedule breakdown. The contract is a not to exceed contract. We're here on an emergency ordinance for the contract with Titan Utilities. It is being paid on a time and materials basis. And the contract is for the establishment of a temporary force main, condition assessment of the existing force main, and repair or replacement of the force main based on findings. And Titan Utilities has been awarded this contract.
Excuse me for a second, Aaron. Mm-hmm. Is that end date correct?
The end date?
Yes, on this current project?
February
of this year?
No, that'd be February 21. And yes, good catch there. Sorry about that. And as I mentioned, the schedule may actually be reduced. We're currently looking at completion near December 1st of 2020. And that concludes the presentation. Happy to answer questions.
Very good. And good catch there, Commissioner Hardesty, once again validating our detail and nerdly status as a city council. Thank you. Commissioner Udaly, you have your hand raised, but I've come to find out that you probably don't really. So good. Any further?
So, Mayor Wheeler, I can't. Yeah, oh, I have sorry. A question, but I can't find my. There we go. Thank you very there much. You it's all right. On slide 7, Aaron, there were multiple different colors, yes. which weren't the neighborhood association boundaries. What do the colors mean, please?
This is a basin map. So it's I believe we're just using this as an identification of collection system areas throughout the city. Paul, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this.
I think you're right, Aaron. It's the various collection system basins. So that's showing which basin goes to the Inverness pump station.
Okay. Thank you very much. That was interesting.
Very good. Any further questions? Keelan, is there any public testimony?
No one has signed up.
This is an emergency ordinance. Please call the roll.
Udaly.
Aye.
Fritz.
Thank you again. Aye.
Ryan.
Yes, thank you. I can certainly see why it was an emergency. Aye.
Hardesty.
Well done. Aye.
Wheeler.
There is no world in which we would not fill that hole. I vote aye. Thanks for your hard work and your attention to this matter on an urgent basis. The ordinance is adopted. 805.
Thank you. Update drainage and water quality code provisions to facilitate the implementation of the stormwater management manual and the source control manual.
Commissioner Fritz.
Last run on the agenda before we go back to the other item. So the Bureau of Environmental Services requires property owners and developers to treat and manage stormwater runoff and on-site pollutants to protect rivers and streams, public health, property, and our environment. This ordinance asks City Council to replace the drainage and water quality rules that were originally adopted 11 years ago in 1999. And I was instrumental in getting those. No, it's 21 years ago, sorry. 21 years ago, I actually helped advocate for getting the stormwater management manual adopted. So it's kind of fun to have this one come back just as I'm about to leave the council. The proposed revised code focuses on language modernization and reorganization and is coordinated with associated administrative rule revisions, including the source control manual and the stormwater management manual. Here today with a presentation are Marvita Redding, the delivery programs manager, and Adrian Iona, the supervising engineer with the Bureau of Environmental Services.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning, Council and Mayor. I'm Arvita Redding. I am the group manager for the delivery programs, a newly formed group with Environmental Services. This group is focused on individuals, businesses, and community in terms of looking at community engagement, education, partnerships, incentives, and other regulations. The Stormwater Management Manual is part of that in order to protect water quality and to also enhance the watershed. I have with me today Adrian Aona, who is our new manager for our code and rules section, and she's going to give the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Marvita. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm gonna share my screen and start my presentation. All right, hang on, let me start the slideshow. All right, everyone, can you see the presentation? All right, I'm gonna get going. My name is Adrian Iona, and I am the manager for the Code, Rule, and Manual team for BES. I'm here today to present an update to Chapter 1738. Chapter 1738 is our drainage and water quality section of the code. Quick introduction, BES manages the environment. This section of code, drainage and water quality, is part of our code authority that allows us to protect water quality in the city of Portland. Like Commissioner Fritz said, it is has been in place since 1999. It helps us protect streams and rivers, groundwater, and our city systems. It's a key component to our compliance with state and federal environmental permits and helps us comply with the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act. It gives us authority to require management of stormwater and to control pollutant generating activities on sites. This code supports the authority for the Source Control Manual, the Stormwater Management Manual, and the Maintenance Inspection Program. The Source Control Manual regulates pollutant generating activities on sites and in the right of way. It applies to a number of different activities, including hazardous waste storage and handling on industrial sites, trash enclosures and storage, gas stations, and a variety of other uses. The Stormwater Management Manual requires stormwater management for development projects that are adding or altering impervious area. And the Maintenance Inspection Program provides ongoing inspections of stormwater facilities that were installed for compliance with the Stormwater Manual to ensure their ongoing operations. The sort of group of these codes and rules are in alignment with the comprehensive plan and some specific goals in there, including improvement of watershed health, minimizing the environmental impacts of development, focusing on green infrastructure for meeting our infrastructure needs. This also supports BES's ability to provide our stormwater service and reduces risks to human and environmental health and safety. I'm going to give a quick summary of the changes and benefits that we're kind of realizing in this update. The update is a comprehensive rewrite and reorganization of this code chapter. We've undertaken that to improve the clarity, to simplify language, and we're updating it in parallel with our administrative rules to kind of just strengthen the consistency between the two. The changes in 1738 do not expand our authority. They modernize language, including our definitions. We've revised all of the language to include gender-neutral language. And we've removed a few specifics from the code that are better addressed in administrative rule. I'm gonna give a quick overview of the process. So for 1738, we've run those updates along with updates to the Stormwater Management Manual. Those two items together were out for public comment in June of 2020. For that public comment period, we did direct outreach to the development community, through our neighborhood coalition offices. The Office of Civic Life approved list of diversity and civic leadership organizations and other interested parties. We hosted three separate information sessions to cover the changes, and we had over 100 attendees at those sessions. Also this year, we're updating the source control manual. It was out for public comment in August. During the public comment period for 1738, we did not receive any comments on the code update itself. So the schedule for adoption, pending your vote today, 1738 would go into effect in early November. And then we're anticipating that the associated updates to the stormwater manual and the source control manual will take effect later this year with approval from our director. I want to acknowledge that this work took a lot of help from a lot of different people across the Bureau, and want to give particular recognition to the project manager for the code update, Alice Coker, who brought together all these different voices and drafted the code and the ordinance package for this. So with that, I'd like to say thank you for your time, and I'm open to any questions that the council might have.
Great. Fabulous presentation. Colleagues, any questions?
Commissioner Fritz, do I need to stop sharing my screen for you?
Yes, please.
Yes, I'm trying. There it is. Okay.
Great. I don't see any questions. Keelan, do we have anybody signed up for public testimony on this item?
No, no one signed up.
All right. With that, then, we'll call the roll. I'm sorry, it's a non-emergency item. I was jumping the gun. We'll take this up next week. Commissioner Fritz has her hand raised.
Yeah, I just wanted to take the opportunity while staff are here to express how very excited I am about this particular code update. It's more important than you might know. For those of us living in Southwest, stormwater management that isn't just going into a pipe is especially important. And so I really appreciate this. Also, Deputy Director Dawn Ochiyama's longtime advocacy on this issue, first as a member of the Tran Creek Watershed Council and now as the Deputy Director. So thanks to everybody.
Thank you. This is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Thank you for a very, very clear presentation. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And now we're going back to Tia tells me it's item 8. I'm sorry?
Excuse me, Mayor Wheeler.
Yeah.
I just wanted to take a moment and appreciate Marvita, who, my gosh, I haven't seen forever, who is still working for the city, providing us excellent service. So I have never seen her at council, so wanted to take a moment to appreciate her. Thank you.
Very good. We are returning to item 800, and there was questions about from PBOT on any local participation in that contract with the federal dollars.
That is correct.
Thank you, Mayor. I believe I have Steve from PBOT here to answer questions. I don't see his.
I see him.
Yes.
Okay, there we go. Yes, welcome. So I'm not sure if you're up to speed, but both Commissioner Hardesty and I would like an explanation for why PBOT wasn't able to achieve the city's utilization rate of 20%. We understand that this is partially funded by federal dollars, and we have no ability to compel ODOT to hew to our standards, but why weren't we able to achieve that utilization rate with our own dollars?
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. And for the record, Steve Sigethy, PBOT Capital Project Manager. Thanks for having me. Yes, indeed. This is a federal aid project We received a federal grant in the amount of $5,267,000. And as you noted, we are with approximately $5 million of PBOT funds, including transportation system development charges and some general transportation revenue. As you noted, Commissioner Udaly, we are delivering this project as a federal aid project. We are a certified agency to deliver these federal aid projects. And as part of that, these projects end up being administered through the Oregon Department of Transportation. And in particular, ODOT's Office of Civil Rights ends up being the ultimate regulator of the utilization. So they, at the prior to bidding this project, ODOT established a minimum requirement of 12%. And as I think the council has seen, this particular contractor has proposed a utilization of DMWESB certified.
Steve, I'm sorry to interrupt, and unfortunately, we sort of parachuted you in the middle of a conversation, and I think that was covered pretty thoroughly and well during the presentation. I think there was a more specific question, which was just, does the city have money in this project? Does PBOT put money in alongside? And if so, under what terms?
He yes. did answer that, but the point is that it's administrated by ODOT, so their rules apply. And so it sounds like we need to apply pressure to ODOT to raise their own standards. And Steve, if you could briefly explain the critical nature of this project and what it would, well, whether we even have the ability to reject the contract and put it back out to bid and what that would mean for us as far as a timeline with a kind of diminishing window, I think, to do work in the roadway.
I did not hear an answer to the question of how much money PBOT is putting into this contract. So if you said it, I didn't hear it.
That amount is just over $5 million of PBOT funds and includes transportation system development charges and general transportation revenue. So it's about $5.2 million
$5.2 million, and the rest of it is ODOT's dollars. And yet,
that's correct.
ODOT's
that is correct.
Bulk of the money is ours.
It's correct. About a 50-50 split in this case.
Where's the other $5 million? Because what I'm seeing is this contract is $5.6 million. Where's the rest of the money going?
Right. The rest of the money was used during the design phase and the right of way phase. So the right-of-way phase was approximately $600,000 of easements and property acquisition, and the remainder, the balance of that, was design costs.
Got it. Thank you.
Yep. Regarding Commissioner Udaly, your question about the importance, it would be difficult to go back out. You know, our federal aid projects are on a timeline that is watched closely by both FHWA as well as Metro and ODOT. This is a project that had a number of delays in the past. So we had just met the deadline of getting this out to bid before the federal fiscal year closed down on September 30th. So that would be a challenge. And I know, I guess on the community side, for what it's worth, I would say that the community has been looking forward to this construction of building out our pedestrian bicycle network, the low-stress, family-friendly network of walking and biking routes. If it's helpful, I do have a map of the project. I will stand by if that's desired.
Not helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah. It is in East Portland, correct?
That is correct. Almost entirely east of Interstate 205.
All right. Thank you.
Good. That's helpful. Thank you, Steve, for joining us and giving us some clarification. Colleagues, I'll entertain a motion.
If I may, Mayor, I have one more question.
Oh, yeah, you bet, of course.
Thank you. So, Steve, let's say we reject this contract today. What's the process to to actually get a better contract that actually, yeah, we want the infrastructure, but we also want people to benefit from public dollars. And I don't see that reflected in this. So what happens if we reject this?
Thank you, Commissioner. I think we would be in a difficult spot because on these federal aid projects, as well as on the low bid process in general, and perhaps Lester would be able to speak to the low bid process in general, we just don't have much authority to set required targets. They've been aspirational on our side, and then for this particular federal aid projects, we do have a required minimum, and that's the 12%. But we just don't have any authority to go above that. And I believe that's why, as you know, we've been looking at a number of projects, larger projects, using alternative methods of contracting where we are reached those higher utilization numbers.
Yeah, well, we don't have a record of that just yet. So I'm concerned because if we've already invested $5 million, I don't know who benefited from that $5 million, right? And if we continue down this track that we're on, we will continue to be passing the buck to somebody else. We can't do anything because it's the feds. We can't do anything because it's state. So thank you. I really appreciate you coming in cold and trying to answer questions that I had. I really appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
All right. Very good. Does that answer everybody's questions for now? I'll entertain a motion.
I move the report.
Second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Udaly, a second from Commissioner Fritz. Keelan, please call the roll.
Udaly.
Well, I certainly understand my colleagues' concerns and frustrations, but the fact is PBOT has actually done an amazing job at meeting and exceeding our aspirational goals. And in this particular project, we are restricted by the rules of the federal government or ODOT. It doesn't sound like rebidding is an option. It's an important project, and I'm really happy to see it proceed. I vote aye.
Fritz.
Thank you, Commissioner Udaly, for delaying voting on the project to be able to get staff to answer our colleagues' questions. I appreciate that. Aye.
Ryan.
Yes, thank you, and thanks, Steve, for coming in and clarifying. I concur with the comments made by Commissioner Hardesty. However, I'm also really, and we have to look at that. It's been two votes today where there's been a force greater than the city that's influenced outcomes. I just want to say the area of town that you're doing this in is a high need, and it's been long overdue. I know Vision Zero data has not been looking good, and a lot of it's because of the unsafe pedestrian arterials in East Portland. I know that Glen Fair Elementary in the Reynolds School District is really close to there, and it's the demographics of that school are vastly high poverty and majority minority, and the parents are often walking their children to school without sidewalks and without the safety precautions. So on behalf of all those families and the pedestrians in East Portland, aye.
Hardesty.
Well, again, thank you, Steve. Thank you, Commissioner Udaly, for getting answers to my questions. I will say that on June 17th, when the City Council passed Resolution 37492, we made a commitment that we would adopt anti-racism, equity, and transparency as part of how we would do business in the city of Portland moving forward. This project does not actually provide opportunities for folks who are in desperate need of work. I live in East Portland. I know how bad the infrastructure is and how necessary this project is, but that is not a reason to vote for something that doesn't equitably provide opportunity for the folks who live in East Portland. And so I vote no.
Wheeler.
I'll vote aye. The report is accepted. And Keelan, that completes our work for this morning. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Good meeting. We are adjourned.